Carry on.
Oh crap, you did start recording again, didn't you?
Yeah, he did.
Bastard.
Was he?
Oh god, Ken Fallon did too.
Yeah, there's someone out there who wants to listen to you for 4 hours. Shame to me. Well, not 4 hours quite, but yeah, you know what I mean.
There have been people that have been, you know, upset that I'm no longer podcasting as much as I used to, so.
They better go and listen to this then, because there's loads of it.
I'm horribly upset, 3:30.
Yeah, you sound like it.
Ken Fallon's band on the theme jig anyway, in the chat.
I did have somebody send me a message on IRC about a year ago that was like threatening my life if I didn't start podcasting again. I don't know that I've ever said anything worth hearing ever, but some people wanted it. I think they just missed Linux Cranks, though.
But yeah, you did another podcast, was it?
Yeah, those were the good, bad times. Where I would go pick a fight with random person in the... Well, it wasn't random, it was always people I thought had done some horrible disservice to the free and open source community, and then I would get in a big ass fight with them, and then everybody on that podcast would we created memes is what happened. I would get pissy with somebody, and then it would go forever on the show as like an inside joke.
Does this count as a show? I mean, I'm normally doing that, but
if you ever want to have a good waste of time, try to find the old archives of Linux Cranks. It was bad. It was funny, but it was bad. We were doing it as seasons, but the seasons would change randomly. So it would go from like season one, then there was season two, then it went to like season four, and there was no season three. But we kept making references to things that were said in season three that never actually happened, and then like it was strange.
Yeah, I mean, there's all these podcasts about that, but I said it earlier, but I tend to just like listen to music on the computer if I'm going to listen to something normally, you know.
Yeah, I go through I'll listen to podcasts in phases. About the only thing I've actually stuck with is some of the stuff on the Smodcast network, but it's because I like hearing fat stoners talk. It speaks to me in a way that no one else can.
I think somebody did like a 24-hour one before, or 48, or apparently, you know, so I guess some people have. You know, I mean, where you like sit there all the time for the 24 hours, unless you go for except for little breaks or something.
Yeah, a site called Fred.com did one. They do one every year for a thing called Red Nose. It's a charity. They do a 24-hour podcast where they bring people
red,
on.
Red Nose. We've got Red Nose Day here, so yeah, it could be the same thing.
Yeah, it is. It's the same thing. It's a charity that's not very big here in the U.S. Like, we just... I don't know what the hell it is. I know comedians are involved, and that's it. But he does a 24-hour podcast, you know, and accepts donations during that time for the Red Nose thing.
Yeah.
Twit did a 24-hour network-wide thing this year where the hosts of individual shows had an hour block, and they would, you know, they kind of do what we did, but, you know, on a much more sane schedule. But, you know, they copied it from us, so, you know. Once again, Leo Laporte stealing from the Hacker Public Radio community.
It's starting to get dark here now. It was morning and whatever, and it's starting to get dark.
The day has passed you by.
Yeah, but, you know, it's winter, and it's, like I said, it's just a rain day and so on anyway, so. But yeah, it's a bit past 4 o'clock now, so it's starting to get dark.
So you know you don't have to stick around just because of me. If you want to bail, you can.
No. Yeah, I know. I'm quite happy doing this at the moment, actually.
You damn English people with your politeness. Go for it, K-Wisher.
So 3:30. Are you still located in Indiana?
Unstinking, fortunately.
Down by Pegwell?
Yeah, we're still too close for comfort, but he does no longer live with me.
You guys supposed to get any snow tonight?
I have no idea. Let me see.
We're under winter weather advisory.
I'll go for a break for a bit, but if you're still on or whatever, then might carry on a little bit longer. But I'll be back in a bit, if not, anyway. But...
All right, take it easy.
No, I'll probably be back quite soon. I just need a break from the computer, you know.
Got to stretch your ass muscles.
It's always important.
Kay Wisher can chat to you in the meantime, I guess, or whatever.
So, are you still working for that monastery?
Yeah.
What do you have a? Don't if I remember correctly, don't you have a mix of, or are you all Mac there?
We are a mix. Everything on the server side is Linux, except for two or three things that absolutely had to be Windows. But it's still their servers running desktop versions of Windows, even so. It's not. There's no. Server infrastructure being served by Windows servers. The user land is about 70% Windows, and the rest is Mac. I'm the only Linux machines in user land are in my office or in the computer lab.
And of that 30% that are Mac users, do you have any type of centralized management system for those?
No, we don't do any centralized management of anything.
Well, I was curious because at the school system I'm working at, we're slowly, and I don't know how permanent it's going to be in the future, but we now have one student lab of 30 iMacs, and we have a teacher pilot program going on with 25 MacBook Airs, and I'm finding it difficult to manage those, imaging them and stuff like that, and maybe being able to push out apps and stuff like that.
Yeah, we don't do any kind of that. Really, I'm the only person there. We have one contractor that does the infrastructure stuff, but other than that, it's just me. So, centralized management has never been something that they've even begun to think about.
Our main infrastructure is Windows Server with Active Directory, and I got centralized control over the Windows desktops, and I use Fog for my imaging purposes. But we're trying to figure out some type of solution for the Mac side, because I can integrate, I can join the Macs to AD fine, so that the users can get to their Windows shares, their server storage. But beyond that, that's about it.
Yeah, we kind of do everything back-assward at the seminary where I am, because it's always been done that way, and they don't want it changed. Everyone is the administrator of their machine, so stuff happens sometimes, and it's like, I can't believe you did that. Okay, let's visit.
Yeah, our staff are admins, but lab machines that students use, they're not. But yeah, that's why I have Fog. When staff work up their PC, I said, well, I hope you got your stuff backed up on the server, because you're getting a fresh image. If I can't fix a problem in 10 minutes, then it's getting a new image.
Yeah, I'm lucky that the people who mess with things kind of know what they're doing, and the people who don't know what they're doing are terrified of the computer. So it totally works out. No one's screwing with stuff.
So do you have some type of a imaging system in place where you can just smoke it and put on a fresh image?
No, because the end users all have they all have different workflows, and they're always doing things completely different from everyone around them. So a kind of central image is almost impossible.
Well, yeah, I know what you mean, because I deal with, because I'm like you, I'm the main dude, and we've got elementary staff and high school staff, so each building, each, you know, type of curriculum has different needs for software, but what I do is build the image with all software on it, and if teachers, you know, if I get a mass influx of, hey, I need this, I need that, well, then I'll add it to the master image, and you get what's on that image, whether you use it or not.
I think my predecessors had been doing that at one point, but whatever system they were using was no longer in any kind of working order. So in the last 2 years, all I've really been doing is archaeology and putting out fires.
You gotta have a look at Fog. It's very, a very nice imaging system.
Is it open source?
Oh yeah, it's kind of in a stalemate for development. They haven't released a new version lately, but I'm still running it on Ubuntu server 10.04. because that was kind of the last Ubuntu version they supported, and have no problems, you know, smoking and imaging XP Windows 7 machines.
So how does Fog compare to something like Clonezilla?
Well, Fog is more like a centralized management system. I don't have to go to, I've never tried, I know you can build a Clonezilla server, but I've never tried that, but Fog's kind of already pre-set up for this purpose, so you don't have to do a lot of back-end work to get it up and running, and I can fire up the web GUI and pick a machine and say, okay, this image needs to be imaged, and I schedule it for an image, and if the machine supports Pixie booting, well, I don't even have to go to the machine. It'll just automatically reboot and start the image process. So I don't have to do a lot of legwork traveling to each machine. And so that's one of the benefits of it.
Pretty slick, pretty slick.
And it's all free.
That's even better.
Luckily, we have only, we are all Dell-based on our workstations, except for the Macs, of course. But I have... The bad thing is about Fog is you have to, well, I'm sure you could do it if you really wanted to do the back end work, but to create a stock sys prepped image to where you didn't have to maintain an image for each hardware style and type of machine, but I just always kept an image for each hardware base. And, you know, about every 3 months, I'll have to download that image onto one of my machines in my office and get it updated and then re-upload the image. But, so that's one drawback of it. But like I say, it's not that difficult to do. We have a centralized Windows Update server on, you know, on our LAN. So that helps with, you know, keeping the machine, even though if I blast an image down, it's 3 months old, it automatically talks to the update server and does the updates, the Windows updates automatically. But if there's any like Firefox updates or stuff like that, then I'd have to manually do that on an image and then re-upload the image. And you can also push out applications too with it in a rudimentary. I mean, I wouldn't want to push out Microsoft Office with it, but I can do small apps I can push out and changes with. I can push out registry changes, but then I've got, you know, Active Directory to do some of that stuff also.
That sounds cool. I'm going to check it out.
It's a little bit of legwork to get set up and going, but once you get all your machines registered with the Fog server, that's the hard part, because you have to manually visit each machine to, when you Pixie boot it, you come up with a Fog menu, and you have to go through a you just start the process of registering that workstation with the server, and it records, it identifies each machine by MAC address, and then you can give it a unique name, and you can group machines into groups like a lab, so I can multicast a whole lab of 30 machines at one time and stuff like that. I've got scripts that they call them snap ends and fog that will run after the imaging process to it renames it, will rename it, give it the new host, give it its proper host name, and then automatically join it to Active Directory after the imaging process also. I think the website is fogproject.org is the website where you can get all the information you need to know.
Could you post that in the IRC or in the chat window?
I see on the website that looks like their site's going to be down for maintenance, which is, as you can see from the postings there, it's the first post since 2011, so maybe that project is still active, I hope. But it's a very simple install on a base Ubuntu server install. In the past, I've even virtualized this server on our VM system. Right now, since we're virtualizing everything, I had a physical server become available that I moved it over to. So now I've got it on a physical box, but it does work in a virtualized environment also. 3:30, did you fall off your chair?
No. Just being distracted by things.
You coaxed me in here, so I'm here for the stimulating conversation.
What kind of stimulation you after, big boy?
Any and all kinds.
Damn, I didn't know it was this type of time to chattel here. I didn't realize that.
Well, we'll have to keep it family friendly, I think. So use any windows.
Hey man, Kay Wisher, you're a Myth TV guy, and I've been off and on with Myth TV only because I've been so involved with, you know, DevOps type of stuff. And, you know, I had started out with Not Myth a long time ago, and then that project morphed over to left Debian to Arch. And it's now called, I forgot what the project is called now, but I did want to get back into it. Are you using, you said, I think you're a Comcast subscriber. Had you had any experience with UVerse or anything like that?
No, I haven't. My area where I live, I can't get UVerse, so I've just stuck with Comcast and using antenna.
Oh, so you actually use over-the-air antenna, huh?
I use both. I've got quite an extensive Myth TV setup here. I've got two back ends. One back end, I have a Silicon Dust HD Home Run Prime with a cable card in it so that I can get my Comcast encrypted crap that they won't allow. They starting in the middle of December, they just now quit providing free QAM signal, so that now everything is encrypted. So, but that isn't the reason I went with the Prime box. It was because I wanted to quit renting their set-top box, so I've switched to that, and that's, so I still have to rent the cable card for it for $8 a month, and then so I'm able to get everything except for like the Prime movie channels like HBO and the pay-per-view stuff, which I don't care about anyway. But then I've got a second back end that's connected to an antenna in my attic that I record the free over-the-air digital stuff. So all in all, I've got 7 tuners on my network.
That's interesting. You're still talking. I just came back for a little bit. I'll be back in a bit again. I'm having lunch and about to, so. But I might as well carry on, I guess, if we still want to chat.
I highly recommend the network-based tuners. They're quite easy to set up. You don't have to open up a box and put in a physical tuner. You don't have to worry about firmware. The HD Home Run series works very well. Like I say, the Prime is a cable card-based unit, and it has 3 tuners in it. Then for my antenna needs, I just, since Comcast started encrypting everything, I was, you know, recording their open QAM signals from cable into a box. But since they switched, I went and purchased a HD, just a standard HD home run unit that has two tuners in it. And so now I have four tuners pulling off my antenna and the three on the cable side.
It's pretty impressive. I had been tooling around with a Pentium 4. I think it was an i80 something i810 chipset. This is like, I'm going back like four years ago when I first set up my Myth box. It was a Myth back end front end combo. These days I'm in the process of trying to rebuild and get something a bit more bust, something on the order of a dual core machine. That's all I really need, is a back end with some sort of NVIDIA card that understands the GPU, understands the processing that I would need to take the load off of this CPU. I forgot what that library is called.
VDPAU.
Exactly.
Yeah, that box you just described would, as long as you got plenty of storage, would make a perfect back end. You don't need much as far as, you know, hardware, you know, a beefy system for a back end. The front end, it could also, you know, be a front end also, as long as you had the correct, you know, NVIDIA card in it. I think in my main box, I'm still using a GeForce 8600 to feed my TV, and it works fine.
So you don't think I really need to upgrade my my box, my processor, and all that good stuff?
No, because with the, you know, since they came out with the VDPAU libraries, that offloads all the video processing to the GPU, and it doesn't take much as far as, you know, CPU and hardware wise for a back end. Well, the front end's where it's taking advantage of the VDPAU, because it's what's sending the signal to the TV. But as far as if you're just going to be a back end only, yeah, no problem. And even if you put in an NVIDIA card into it, you could use it for a front end also.
So let's talk about front ends for a second. Well, on my back end, I actually have a couple of tuners. I still got the old PVR 250s in there, which I can't use anymore because, as you already know, Comcast has encrypted most of their channels across the country at this point. I also have in there the old HD TV tuner cards that came out when the broadcast flag was real popular, or at least it was threatening the broadcast flag. I got one of those also. I guess the HD 3000 is what I have in there.
Who's the manufacturer of it?
PC HD TV is the manufacturer. A guy named Keller or something like that. He brought out this hardware right as the broadcast flag was threatening, you know, to wreak havoc. And it only runs on a Linux box. And I have the first generation HD tuner for that one. I have since picked up a cable card, and I do plan to get the HD Prime, HD Home and Prime cable card as a tuner. So that would give me, you know, I guess the HD Prime has three tuners in it, plus the HD 3000 I have, that would give me four tuners. I think that's how HD Prime cable card works. Is that correct?
Yes, it's got three onboard tuners, so you can watch live TV and be recording, you know, two other streams with that one unit. Now, I'm not familiar with the card you mentioned, but is it can do digital signals?
Yes, it can do digital. It also has QAM in there too, or CAM, or however you pronounce it.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to use that with Comcast. You'd have, if you wanted to hook up an antenna to it, you could use that.
Exactly.
Is it just a single tuner, or is it a dual?
I think it's single. I have to look at the card. It's been a while. I even have one of those infrared channel changers on that sucker, man, an IVTV deal. So I have a very old system.
Yeah, I just use I've got a Microsoft Media Center USB IR receiver, and then I had the remote that came with it. Since then I've switched over to a Logitech Harmony that works with that same receiver. So.
Yeah, I heard a lot about the Logitech Harmonies. That's what I'm looking to pick up as well.
They're very nice. I was in my local Sam's Club one, I think it was about, you know, Christmas time last year, and they had one of the, I can't even remember the model number of it, but it's not nothing fancy. It just has the black and white LCD panel on it. It's nothing fancy, you know, and it's programmable, which is what I like, because I could, was able to program it with Linux, and you also upload the programming gets stored on your account on the Logitech site, so if you ever happen to lose it, you can plug it in and download your programming right back to it. Another possibility for a front end is to use XBMC, because it has a add-in for Myth TV that you can actually use XBMC for your front end purposes. It's got a really nice interface on it.
So did you build your own front ends, or did you purchase a over-the-counter shrink wrap type of front end? How did you do that?
The first system was a back-end front-end system that I just custom built. I ordered all the parts. I did all my research. I even talked with Pat DeVille off of Tilts, because he's a big Myth TV. He advised me on my hardware, which at the time, the tuners were the biggest obstacle about, you know, 7 years ago. So I just bought it wasn't a real expensive media center type case, and it sits on top of my ancient rear projection TV that I'm hoping will die anytime soon, so I can get a nice flat panel. Myth TV's really come a long way since I started, and probably about the same time you started too. It's really, really quite easy to get set up and going, especially with the network based tuners like the Silicon Dust units. They are automatically recognized. You don't have to jump through hoops to get the firmware and drivers working with it. They automatically work, and as long as you got Schedules Direct subscription, that works real nice for doing all your scheduling and stuff.
Yeah, the Linhess is the distribution I was going to use on my box.
Yeah, I tried that years ago, I think back before this. What was it called before?
It was Not Myth.
Yeah, I tried that one when I didn't care for it. But now I just run stock Zubuntu and then install the Myth TV on top of Zubuntu on my machines is what I, as much as I getting to despise Ubuntu, but it's the quickest and easiest setup for me to use their packages for Myth TV and the Mythbuntu packages.
Yeah, I think I'll stick around with the Linhess only because it has Arch, and I had never played with Arch before, and I always like to get an opportunity to broaden my horizons whenever possible.
When are you guys going to grow up and cut the cable?
Well, the only reason I still have it is because I'm married.
Same here. Ditto.
See, you guys got to get rid of the kryptonite.
If it was up to me, I could cut the TV as far as Comcast goes and keep their internet only. But I could be totally happy with just what's free over the air and what I can stream from the internet.
Yeah, I hate network television. The only time I ever watch is when I'm watching sports or something like that. Everything else can be recorded as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I don't even watch live TV anymore with Myth TV's commercial skipping. It's just, I don't have time to sit and watch, what is it, on an hour broadcast, about 15 minutes worth of commercials.
Yeah, but my wife loves reality. She's reality crazy, you know, and Oprah and all that stuff. So, it's tough to it's a tough sell to get rid of the cable altogether.
I hear you.
See, I did it the easy way. I was just poor for a long time and couldn't afford it.
Well, that's how you got to do it, yeah.
I'm sure, you know, choosing poverty to get rid of cable would probably not do well for your marriages or anything.
It'd be like starting over again. Go poverty, then you lose your wife, you know, that type of deal.
Well, don't think of it as losing a wife. Think of it as gaining freedom.
Gotcha.
Sorry, I googled up my own bullshit there for a second.
Hey, so at 3:30, I think you're not far from my residence. You're in that the wilderness of Michigan too, aren't you?
No, I am in the meth capital of the world, Richmond, Indiana.
Well, that's even worse.
Oh yeah.
I think I'm closer to you than 330. I'm up around the Kokomo, Indiana area.
Ah, yeah, yeah. That's big time manufacturing facilities out there.
Yeah, that's a plus and a minus.
You're like, yay, there are jobs. Crap, the air quality.
Well, we don't have a whole lot of air quality issues, but the jobs are slowly disappearing because of overseas competition.
Yeah, that's what happened to Richmond in the 70s. And ever since then, the only thing we could manufacture is sadness and methamphetamines.
So you must be Breaking Bad all day.
My neighbor, the place I used to live, my neighbors were. It was actually bad enough that my girlfriend had read online that you could make meth in a 2-liter bottle. So then when it exploded, because you didn't do it right, it would only blow up a small portion of something, not, you know, the entire block. And so we walked around our neighborhood talking loudly about it. We knew we couldn't stop them from cooking meth, but we were hoping that we could convince them to do it in the smallest container possible so that they only blew off their arms instead of the neighborhood. I moved up, though. I now live in a heroin neighborhood. That's always lovely.
It was different clientele altogether. See, you went from bad to worse.
I went from bad to a whole nother kind of bad. I don't know if it's worse, because, I mean, meth heads are... That's just wrong. Heroin addicts, you know, at least they're kind of chilled out. It's the desperate thing that gets me about heroin addicts, you know, the kind of desperate pleading and begging thing, because I'm kind of the soft-hearted person, so I try to help people, and you realize you can't help them. So how did you go from Brooklyn to all the other places to end up in Michigan, of all places?
Oh, damn, that's a long story, man. How much time you got?
I got time. If you only want to hit the highlights or the weird stuff, you can do that too, but...
Let's just say I opted to serve my country. So after doing so, I ended up going to school down south. And from there, after spending X amount of years in school, I got offers in the Midwest of all places. So, yeah, I left home when I was about 17. So that's kind of how it worked out. It wasn't like I had a clandestine plan to come out to the Midwest, because I know nothing about this type of lifestyle, you know. So it was that, I came out here for like a hired desperado, you know, for a job offer. That's kind of how that worked out.
Cool. I always like to hear stories of, you know, what brought people to different places, because I've lived in Indiana my whole life. So, you know, I came from a small town. Our first people of color in my town moved in when I was in fifth grade, and people weren't too happy about it. And I didn't understand it, because my mom came from a city, so like I didn't have this concept of racism or anything. It's like I didn't understand what was going on. Then we moved from there to the west side of Indianapolis, where my nickname was White Boy. And then I moved to Richmond, that's somewhere in between. But I still get creeped out sometimes when I'm around too many white people.
You realize white boy is a term of endearment, right?
I was hoping so, but it didn't always feel like one.
Hey, guys.
Wait, who the hell was that?
It was Pokey.
Oh, God.
Here's some stimulating conversation.
You made me just think 330. We were talking about growing up and meeting your first black person. I grew up in the city, and my best friend was half black, but I never knew it. I like, my parents never, you know, raised us with that. And it was so funny, because I just remember when I was a young kid, my dad worked in a youth correctional facility, and all I knew about black people at the time was they didn't get a fair shake, they couldn't swim, and they laughed at him after they went swimming in the locker room.
So I gather 330 that you did a little history, or maybe you caught some of the gist of my previous conversation when I was on a little earlier. So I guess you surmised that I might be a person of color?
No, I surmised that you were from Brooklyn, and the color thing was just a podung middle of the country thing.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, Brooklyn is majority. I always tell people Brooklyn is one of the few boroughs in New York City that have pockets of white people, whereas every other borough has pockets of black folks. So if you look at so Brooklyn is considered the chocolate or black borough. Whereas, you know, if you go up to Manhattan or some people call it Mecca, Medina, however you want to pronounce it, or Gotham, you know, you got pockets of black folks, and, you know, whether it be Harlem or wherever else you might be talking about. But it's different. It's different.
Michigan's an all right place to live. It's not, like, terribly racist.
It's polarized, you know, for sure. You know, of course, everybody knows the well-documented situation in Detroit. But, Detroit, unfortunately, is a city that has never come out of transition and is many, many years behind, you know, some of the more advanced cities. But, you know, it is what it is. There's not a whole lot you can do. I have my own theory on my blog that I've written about how Detroit can actually resurrect itself and restore itself. But that's a whole nother conversation.
Say, most of Michigan is far too cold for good proper racism. You know, getting the sheet with the quilted stuff underneath is difficult.
I don't know, man. I was in Ohio for a couple of years, and there were two sides of town, and anybody who found themselves on the wrong side of town in either case was a victim. And it was the first time I had ever encountered anything like that. You know, just growing up in Boston and then moving up to New Hampshire, like, I didn't know what racism was. It was just something I read about in books. And then I got out in Ohio, and I was just stunned at the attitudes of people out there. It's one of the reasons I'll never go back to Ohio. I couldn't, the whole time I was there in college, I could not stomach the attitude. And I didn't want to be lumped in with either group, because both groups were haters, you know?
Well, you realize Ohio and New Hampshire are totally different states from a socioeconomic standpoint and also a resource standpoint. I mean, New Hampshire is a very highly technical, I guess I would gather, eventually guess, an information age mecca versus, you know, Ohio, which is really a rust belt type of state.
Where I was, we'd be lucky to see rust. It was just corn.
Say, look, Ohio has a fantastic problem. It's created 23 of our astronauts, which tells you one thing. Ohio is such a shithole that 23 people decided it was better to die in space than live in Ohio.
Yeah, I can understand. I lived in Ohio. I would also want to get as far away as possible, and you can't get much farther than that.
Yeah, Ohio's a huge manufacturing base. And one of the things, you know, coming from New York, coming up here to Michigan, out to the Midwest in general, there's a whole different dichotomy out here. There's a whole different, I guess, mind state, for lack of better words. And it is that people here have grown up to believe that they will run to the factory for a new way of life. And that is pretty much a generational thing here. If you're not working in the auto industry, then you ain't really working. You know, that's kind of how most people think, and it's just what they grow up here to do, and it's just so foreign to me, man. I came from a place where transit is mass, you know, as they say, you know, we call it the iron horse. And, you know, I just never fathomed that, you know, I would be running to a factory. You know, I didn't even have a damn driver's license until I was probably about, you know, 18 years old or so.
Yeah, I worked in a couple of those factories. Yeah. Not much good to say about them. I mean, they're jobs. They are jobs. That is one good thing. But, yeah, I can't say I ever liked going in there. Oh, hey, guys, I got to run. My daughter just emerged from her cave, so I got to run. Good talking to you guys.
Yeah, later on.
All right, later on, man.
So I've got a buddy that just moved to Indiana like a year or so ago from Long Island. And there are some things that, like, seriously bug him about the Midwest. And I want to see if these things ring true for you. He cannot stand how slow everything is.
Yeah, it's pretty slow, man. It is different out here. It really is. Even Detroit is has a lot of southern, I guess, influences, because the natural migration path is straight, you know, north to south or south to north, whatever the case might be. So a lot of people from Mississippi and places like that and Detroit. So it's very slow kind of thinking and everything, really.
And another thing he can't stand is people in the Midwest actually look at you. Like, you know, he's just walking down the street and people look over at him.
Well, people talk. They'll speak to you, you know, in some cases. You know, I have found that to be true. I never, you know, did a whole lot of that when I was growing up in Brooklyn. You know, people were impolite. It's that, you know, it's not something you want to do. It's that, you know, ice grill somebody for no particular reason.
Yeah, it drives him nuts because he's like, what are all these people looking at me for? And I'm like, I don't know, you doing something interesting? He goes, no, I'm just walking.
Funny.
Yeah, it's driving him nuts. But yeah, those are like the two. Yeah, you know, he's like, it's slow. People look at me, and there's nothing to do.
The diversity and things are. You know, there's a dearth of that, you know, in terms of places where you can go eat and stuff like that, restaurants. I guess you could say I'm always looking for geeks, man, and highly technical people so that I can talk to them and, you know, exchange information and we can share with one another. That's the challenges I've had. When I first came out here, I spent a lot of time with the lug. But since, you know, now I'm married and have a child, it's been difficult. So I'm always on the lookout for people that I can talk with. They even started getting into trying to figure out things like this, what do you call it, pair programming stuff, so I could do more Python, you know, and learn more scripting and do more stuff like that, you know. But it's a challenge. It really is.
Yeah, I'm back again just to say that.
Alrighty. Yeah, his thing is he's an artist. And so, like, you know, he moved out to the Midwest because his wife is from around here. And he's like, oh, you know, you know, maybe I can get something going, and he's just finding that, you know, yeah, no one here has the money to pay for, you know, decent art, and the artists from around here, you know, only do art that people will buy. So he, like, his stuff is like way out, you know, it's crazy, and like, you know, like no one around here gets it because it's so informed by New York. You know, yeah, you know, graffiti culture and stuff like that. Like, people look at it and they're just like, what the hell is going on? And I used to do graffiti. Like, I dig it. I'm like, dude, where were you all my life?
Yeah, so you're a graph writer? You probably like to get into stuff. You should get online and check some stuff out, man. When I was growing up, man, you know, the Bronx, you know, that was where most of the graph writers had you know, originated from. And, you know, back in the days, the trains were not graffiti resistant. You know, they actually, in fact, one of the chemists that decided to innovate, for lack of better words, with the MTA, he got into a patent sharing agreement with those guys and just made a mint. He came from my high school, and that development made it impossible for graffiti to stick to the metal out there on the subway. And so then you had a big change in generations, you know, where the graffiti just disappeared.
Yeah, I've anything that I ever get into, I always go back and look at the history of things, and a lot of my knowledge of graffiti came from KRS-One. And so around here, that's like, you know, people are like, oh, who's that, you know, what's all this about? How do you know all this information? And it's like, you know, for someone like you, you're like, yeah, KRS-One. He's a dude. He kicks around here every once in a while and does some shit.
Chris is the teacher for sure.
Yeah,
you gotta check some of his.
Okay, go ahead.
So you gotta check out some of his talks that he's done online. He gets into the culture and to the history of all that stuff. He used to be a graph writer once upon a time too. You know. BGP, Coke, too, all those guys. He used to hang out with them. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No. I don't even remember what I was going to say. Must not have been very important.
Yeah, man, I those are some of the things I miss. But you know what? When you go out to Europe, that culture, you know, graph writing is still alive and well, man. It really is.
Oh, yeah. It's insane. You know, and like the stuff they're writing is, you know, in their own language. So, like, it's all, like, super crazy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Graffiti is starting to get big in Japan. There's a big, you know, cultural thing about, you know, you don't break laws in Japan because it's shameful to do things. And, but yeah, they're starting to do graffiti now, and that's awesome looking. I mean, it's wild.
Oh yeah, definitely in the native language and native script or the native, term I want to use, the native handwriting or the native, you know, that would be definitely interesting to see. Yeah, I gotta get myself going here. I got a couple of projects, man. I gotta learn some iOS. I'm talking about the original iOS, you know, Cisco switching and stuff. I'm trying to get some switches configured here in my basement, and I gotta install some Slackware here on another box so I can get some things going. Some work I gotta do.
Man, working on the first? That's rough.
This is fun stuff. This is, you know, my wife and I, we jointly run a clinic for special needs children. So I'm the operations guy, the chief geek. So my responsibility is the things, you know, all things that are unseen, for lack of better words, to manage, you know, business processes and make sure things work as they're supposed to.
Ah, cool.
Yep, so, you know, that's what I gotta get on here.
All right, well, good luck.
Well, thank you, man. Good talking to you, D30, man. I didn't know that. I learned a lot of things about you. Didn't know that you were a graph writer, man.
Yeah, I'm a recovering graph writer. You know, at almost 30 years old, getting caught doing graffiti is not looked at very well.
Well, I mean, just imagine if you could do it and, you know, get some type of reward for it, whether it be monetary or otherwise, you know.
Yeah, I just do it for fun, and, you know, if I get caught, it's how it's always been.
So be it. Just be glad that you're not, you know, in a rail yard somewhere, or the train yards where the cops will beat your ass.
Because no one's watching, yeah, for real. Have a great day, man.
You too.
Oh, you're Kevin, are you?
He's going. I might go.
Him, yeah.
Yeah, I would... K-Wisher muted and deafened himself. Hey, I start trying out this open dyslexic fonts, and I found out I'm not dyslexic because these are hard as hell to read. For some reason, I thought it said K-Wisher is now muted and defecated.
All right, yeah. taboo things.
Yeah. Definitely something I have to change as soon as I get off of here.
Wait, which? The,
I gotta change that font. It's driving me nuts.
I don't know, where's this font or whatever? It sounds sort of interesting in a way.
I think I found it at opendyslexic.org.
Yeah, dyslexia is an interesting one, actually, in a way, because people think, or they used to think, it's like this, and it's that, and it's this, and it's that. But I think, actually, it's mainly just about the reading. If Ken was here, he would probably have his own comments make on this as well, but I don't think he's around, is he?
No, I think he's lurking in the shadows.
But I think it's mainly about the reading, even though they used to think it was those other things as well in the past, in the 90s, I mean, and things like that.
Yeah, I got to look into it because I transpose numbers a lot. And I thought, oh man, you know, maybe this would help. But I mean, if I really focus on it, I can read it. But otherwise, I can't see a damn thing.
Yeah.
That's a really cool thing, though, to be able to be like, oh, well, I wonder if this would help some minor aspect of my life. I'll just download these free fonts and try them out.
Is that what you did?
Yeah, I just downloaded the font pack and installed it and went in and set it as my, you know, as the fonts to use in GNOME Shell and just tried them out.
Oh, you're using GNOME Free as well, are you then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I should have probably... Actually, that reminds you, earlier I was going to probably do the, like, what distro are you using thing, but I think I forgot, or we moved on, or whatever happened.
I'm using Fedora.
Yeah, so Gloom Free. Okay, so, oh, yes, Trees of Floor and Ambassador earlier, actually, as well. So,
yeah,
that makes sense. Although sometimes people who become a Floor Ambassador or involved with some project, you know, more properly, sometimes they actually sometimes they end up using some other distro as well, or they kind of, or they move on, of course, in one or the other. Because, I think, some people, move on, but sometimes, you know, like in this distro, for example, and I've been there in the past a few times, and somebody comes along on the mailing list or on the IRC channels, possibly, and they're like, I'm from OpenSUSE or whatever it is, you know, and they're like, you know, I really like Madeira as well, and I want to get involved, but I've got my position in this other distro. Sometimes it's like that, you can be involved with more than one distro. You can be a Fedora ambassador or whatever of one distro whilst also contributing to another. I mean, it's not like you've got to do only one, but sometimes people, I think, feel that if they have more proper positions, if you like, if they then suddenly just like decide, right, I'm going to also contribute to this distro, I think they're kind of like traitors to that distro in a way, you know, but it's not really the case. And also, I talked about community getting on and all that earlier, but something else that's good is the whole distro collaboration thing, where distributions or developers, distros, and sometimes the users, I suppose, as well, where they kind of work together and, you know, move the whole thing forward, desktop Linux. And that's the nice thing about FOSDEM as well, actually, because they have a cross distribution developer dev room there, and I assume it will be, next time as well, where you have like your main tracks, and then they do these dev rooms where people are in charge of their own schedule, so Mozilla, legal issues, and so on, and cross distros. And when I went the first time, there was a guy talking who used to be involved with Mozilla. He's moved on to Fedora, I think, but he did his talk about system administration, how he set up some of the infrastructure stuff in Mozilla and things like that. And then I missed it, but there was a good panel talk there's a video of that talk out on the FOSDEM 2012 videos, but there was a good panel talk with the guy, one of the people from Madeira, somebody from Laura, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, the community lady from Ubuntu, very much so, Laura, and there were some other ones, and it's all, but what's nice about the cross-district dev room is because it's all about stuff that kind of applies to all the distros, and that's what the talks are about, you know, which is good. Are you still there?
Yep.
Damn it, Ken.
Ken has came back for.
But every time he unmutes himself, I end up hearing myself repeated.
Did he miss the dyslexia talk we just had, though?
I saw his lips light up, but he didn't talk. I feel like I'm
hunting.
Ken, are you having issues?
No, he's having a bit of fun. It's like I'm deer hunting. You gotta sneak up on it.
He's spying on you. Well, not really, you know, he's there, but yeah.
I wouldn't doubt it. But yeah, the blind allegiances to distros is kind of silly. Yeah, I'm a Fedora ambassador and community manager for Slacker Media, and those two things don't really have anything to do with each other.
Slacker Media is something else, yeah.
Yeah, Slacker Media is a distribution by text file. What you do is you take a base Slackware install and run through this documentation, and at the end of it you get the best the open source community has to offer for doing video, audio, and 3D editing and rendering.
Oh, right, yeah.
My buddy Klaatu developed this whole thing, and he sells it as a book. He gives
the
documentation out for free. He's screwed with me now. It's probably because I called him a pikey earlier. But yeah, it's pretty cool. You go through this whole thing and it talks to you about not just the software, but how you work with it. So it'll help you develop a workflow. It'll help you kind of understand what's going on. So it's not just, it's not just for computer nerds. That worked out well. And it's not
and
just...
It's not...
He's coughing here, isn't he?
I think he just doesn't want anybody talking about Slacker Media or Claw 2.
Fedora, and I bet Ben loves the Fedora talk as well.
Yeah, he gave up. He's no longer recording. But yeah, Slacker Media is pretty cool.
He's disconnected. He's, I don't know.
Listen to me. Hear my voice.
What are you doing, kid?
Can you hear me or not?
Yeah.
No, I can't hear you.
Oh, cool. All right, thanks. Bye. I was editing the audio for the New Year show on the same PC as this, so it has messed up with my audio settings and pulse.
Oh, you mean the first bit of the show?
I mean the 26-hour show that's already started. Do you realize that now people on the stream, there's actually more people on the stream now than there was at the end of the New Year show?
Really? How many on the stream?
There are 26 people listening.
Well, no, they've always said I bring a crowd.
There you go, you the man.
Might not be the crowd you want, but it will be a crowd.
Yeah, they were like listening to 3:30.
Well, you keep waffling, we'll keep recording. Talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Yeah, later on. But yeah, Slacker Media is cool. If you ever have a spare machine and a couple of hours, it's not bad.
Yeah, well, but what is it? You said it's like it sounds like a completely different distro, or something not really known as well.
It's in all reality, it's a document. It is a how-to that takes you from a default Slackware install and builds all of this stuff up on top of it to be able to do video, audio, and 3D creation, rendering, editing, all this like stuff that like I kind of only peripherally understand.
Oh, right, yeah. That's why I haven't really gone into Slackware because of... I didn't even get to Arch, but I got I did try to re-em Arch and so on, but I think it's because you kind of depends on who you are, but you can get used to these distros where you just 20 minutes install like it was longer in the past and 12 minutes and stuff, but you kind of get used to the kind of distros you use, don't you? Sometimes you don't really. Well, yeah, the easier distros, and then you might not move on to the bit more complicated ones, or not as such, depending on the UI and stuff, But Slackware, I think I probably ran some distros from LiveCD that were based on it, or Virtual Machine, or whatever, but I haven't really got into those kind of distros. In a way, I should, but it doesn't just happen,
Say, this is only built on top of Slackware, because that's Claw2's preferred distro. And it's a system that once you set it up, it will never ask for an update. Because, being behind in software, when you've got a production machine that has to keep pumping out video, being behind is better than being ahead and broken.
All right, yeah. I mean, the updates are a bit more stable, is what we're saying.
Well, it will never ask you for an update. It'll never go, hey, there's new updates to... Because you have to, in Slackware, you are the package manager. So you go and you find the updates and you do all of the work for it. So if you've got system...
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
So if you've got an editing system that is perfectly stable and, isn't really connected to the internet, it's a standalone box. You bring you bring your material in on a thumb drive, you plug it in, and you get started. So there's really no need to update it. It doesn't touch anything. It stays within its own little realm there, and never gives you any trouble.
Yeah. Or you can use rolling or you can do out, or you can do whatever over here. Anything, if your own packager, like you said, then you, what about update? I mean, do you need to kind of know what, so let's say security. So normally a distro, you know, you kind of rely on the people who are doing the security updates for that, or that particular distro that you want. But if your own packager, like you're kind of saying for that one, does that mean that for security updates you have to kind of know what's out there and then package it yourself, or what?
It depends on how you use Slackware, because there are a couple of ways to do it. There are package managers that take source packages and, you know, and will build a package out of them and then install it. Or you can, yeah, the updates are released by the Slackware community, and you download source code and you compile it. I mean, in that way you're the package manager, because you've had to manually go out, grab this package, compile it, and install it.
All right, yeah.
You know, and there are a couple of, you know, things that are kind of package managers but not really, that will kind of do that for you. You know, you're like, I want to install these things, and it will go and find those packages and compile the source code and install it. But it's, yeah, all it then is a script that's doing the thing that you would be doing.
Right.
So none of it is really entirely automated.
That's basically what I meant as well. It's sort of, I mean, that you kind of, there's not really automated stuff. You have to sort of do space yourself, so, or like sort of know what's out there and what needs updating.
Well, don't think of it as you have to do it that way. You get to do it that way. They see it as a freedom issue. You have the freedom to update, right, if you so choose. If you don't choose to, we'll just leave you the hell alone.
That's what, yeah, so it's a bit like, it's sort of a bit like if, when a, you know, distro version goes end of life, no more updates officially, you can then, if you have the choice to maintain that yourself and update your kernel and so on, is it a little bit like that in a way, because you've got the, if you see what I mean?
I mean, really, it's, you can put a pair of pants on. They think you're adult enough to be able to handle your own, you know, your own packaging. They're like, you're an adult, act like it.
Right, yeah. But yeah, but what I was going to say as well is actually some people, they, there's a guy I know, and I see, or I've talked to him for a while, but anyway, I remember him saying, like, you know what, I really like Fedora Core 1, right? This guy, or I think it was Fedora Core 1, and so, you know, it's 2003, that distro version or whatever, but, you know, saying this in, like, 2012 or last year or whatever as well, and but what he does, this guy, he's decided for whatever reason that he would rather run a distribution version from years ago and then something more modern and up-to-date and all that, you know, to support it. And so what he does is, quite simply, yeah, he runs, I don't know if he's still doing this now, but anyway, he runs this distribution old version, and he just maintains it himself, kernel and all the rest of it. And people who like Fuduntu, that's another one, that they've got to do that now as well, really, if they want to carry on running it, because he, you know, he dropped support and all that, and the lead developer used to do that, I think, because I know him on IRC a bit, and but he could be, yeah, he moved on. But for that, do you know about anything about Fuduntu, actually? Sure you do.
I know it exists, but beyond that, I never really looked into it. My distro hopping days are kind of behind me.
It existed. They dropped support for it in last year, 2013, because the idea was to basically have a Fedora-based distro that would keep GNOME 2. I'm talking about the real GNOME 2, Andy. You know, the dead project, not Mate, whatever it's called. To have the old GNOME 2 maintained for as long as possible, whilst the original, and they were gonna like start dropping bits of GNOME when they couldn't keep that up to date, because of other changes. Nice idea, and then it would be rolling, and it was rolling release and all that, and it was good for netbooks. Apparently, there was a guy from my lug who really liked the Run 2, so as well. I already knew about it and all that, but this guy, when he said, "Oh, you know what? I've put Stunt on my netbook," I was like, "I thought that's interesting." But yeah, he went for Run 2. He really liked it. But the idea was to keep it up to date with Gnome 2 for as long as possible, basically, whilst getting the latest Linux kernel and so on. But they also named System D as well. I think it was as well. So there were, and then Gnome relying on System D and Gnome 3, but it was made for whatever reason, and I think they found it was too difficult to keep it up to date how they wanted it, so they just dropped the call. And it seems that this guy's moved on to other things anyway, who was better doing it. So, but yeah, it was a nice idea, but that's it. So I think we're kind of stuck with Gloom 2 itself, not mate. I guess there's only really CentOS left now or something like that, isn't there? You know, most distros have moved on, haven't they? Even Debian Stable has gone Gloom 3 as well, and, you know, so yeah, Gloom 2 is pretty much had it now, the proper one, I think. I mean, yeah, are there any distros left with that? CentOS, maybe? Is there anything else? I don't know.
No, it may just be CentOS.
Yeah, CentOS is probably it now, isn't it? Because Debian's stable's got Gnome 3 now, and yeah. Which reminds me, actually, SteamOS, the whole, you know, people were all excited about that, and the whole announcement of how there would be SteamOS, and it would be based on Ubuntu or whatever, and now it's actually been, now they've got their developer preview thing, and it's based on Debian stable with Gnome 3. I've seen some screenshots. But then you need to have, like, apparently UEFI secure boot hardware, and you need whatever, so that's quite a lot to keep us out. But, and then you can't just virtual machine it, but there is a way to get it working in the virtual machine and whatever. And, that's just kind of interesting that they went, in a way, it's interesting they went with Debian stable for the base, I think, but it makes sense because of what they're trying to do, I think. So, that's, instead of going with Ubuntu, whereas they would normally say Ubuntu for Steam otherwise.
Yeah, and, you know, the Debian project, when they say stable, they mean stable.
Well,
this is the distribution that they took 7 years to do a release because, you know, it's ready when it's ready. So, you know, that may be a good base for it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that Debian stable is GNOME 3.4, you know, that's, and now we're on GNOME 3.10.1, so it's like, it's about 2 years behind or something, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, when you want stable, you get stable. Yeah, they don't play around about that. It just, as long as they don't do something goofy like mess with OpenSSH again.
Well, that although Magia is all about stability as well, as well, not to the same extent as Debian stable, but it's 9 months release schedule. If there are delays that hold up the final, any milestone releases, betas, RCs, or alphas, then, well, yes, there will be delays, and there'll be, if delays long enough or whatever, there will be an announcement, it's all very open, they will do a blog post and say, look, we have delayed this release because of, or this milestone release because of, whatever release blockers. This one's very much so about stability, that's one reason for the, well, that's the 9 month release cycle, and also because of, I assume it's due to the amount of contributors. It's not because it's a community distribution. There isn't, it's all non-profit, and it exists because of donations and people giving up their free time as volunteers. There's not quite as many contributors as certain other distros, but the 9 month release cycle, I mean, that it works quite well. Obviously, I said that there will be delays if it needs to be delayed, but it's just one. Actually, the other thing with Magia, when I decided to join, I will get more properly involved. Obviously, once I did that, I found out certain things about more stuff about the projects and so on, and so on. And it's just, I just think it's. I think it's just awesome to be involved with something like that, because when you just use a distribution in general, a lot of people, when if you're just a user of that distribution, you don't really follow the distribution and what's actually going on in the like development process and so on, like quality assurance, what's happening there, and the packages, to some extent, what's happening there, and all that kind of stuff. When you're just a user of it, or pretty much, and you don't really know what's going on in the background, you just kind of use that distro and you just whatever, you might hop off to another distro even. But when you get involved with a distro like I did, this particular distro, I've found out certain things. I've met certain people now since then as well, but who I'm involved in this project. But you just kind of realize how impressive it is to actually make a distro in the first place, especially when it's like a community distribution, because of it's like a jigsaw puzzle in a way, and you need to have all these pieces put together, and to kind of make a distro and make something that's good enough to release. And that's Medea is very much so about release quality. Now, you might think, oh, an alpha is just an alpha and no big deal. It's suspected to be used for testing and for bugs and stuff. But here's the thing, even the alphas, they go basically through the same, pretty much the same testing as the final release will get, because what happens is there's like five, it depends on what bugs are in there, what release blockers are in these millstones and so on, but there can be up to seven or so at most. There can be about seven or so internal quality assurance ISOs for testing, right? And then once they've done that and done certain bug reports and got certain bugs fixed and so on, they will then come out with the alpha, so to the public. So before these millstones even come out, and then the final release at the end, there's all this testing done internally, and that's impressive, because especially when the team is actually quite small compared to probably quite a few other distros, because it's just impressive what people do, because some of these people are testing all six ISOs or whatever it is. There's like 32 bit and 64 bit, so the classical installer ISO for installing all these desktops and so on, the live CDs, live medias, and you know, there are the people in that quality assurance team, they actually there are, you know, at least some of them, or not necessarily everyone, but most people do test most ISOs, but some people really do test every single ISO pretty much, and they're going through all this testing internally that's kind of it's sort of there in the background. You don't really know about this unless you followed what's going on and so on, and then they get to something that they think is good enough to release it, be it an alpha, a beta, an RC, and then a final eventually. So you know, we've got a Medea full release scheduled for release on the 1st of February, time for FOSDEM, after 9 months of development. So I'm just, after all this testing that's been done internally and so on, and you know, I when I used Ubuntu for years, I think I just kind of took it for granted, sort of like, you know, oh, okay, there's a 6 months release cycle, there'll be a new version, there'll be a new version in 6 months, and you know, but when I got involved with this one, I know what's going on in the background, and when you know that, when you know what's actually going on in the background in your chosen distro, I think a lot of people would find that it's hard to just kind of take it all for granted and just think, oh yeah, a few months will go by or whatever, and there'll be a new distro version. Is this what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, my point was, it's all about stability and so on as well, this one as well, as you expect. All the testing and the kind of stuff that people take for granted. But that's what quality assurance teams do. They're in between the packager or the release managers, who tend to be packagers as well. The packager, you could say, and the user, the standard user. And the quality assurance people are the kind of link between, they're kind of in the middle. They have to, the packagers do their thing, and then the quality assurance people test it and do their thing. And then they also release development ISOs to the public, and then there's the testing of updates for more bug reports and so on. And, you know, when you know what's going on in a distro like that, it's... And then when you know, even the issues at times, you know, it's like when you know about some of the issues that have been going on in a particular distro or project, and you know the reasons behind that, I think, personally, I think that's more, that's what makes it interesting as well. It makes it more fun, and you realise, like, look, you realise you're, like, part of something, and you're doing your thing, and yeah, it could apply to any project, that, really. But when you know what's going on, it's hard to just take something for granted and think, you know, that's just software, that's just a distro. Because that isn't the case, because these distros, most of them, have been made by so many different people, putting things together, and of course the upstream projects as well, and it's just amazing, really, what is done, what can be done. But what I think also is amazing is the kind of people who will contribute to these projects at times. You know, sometimes you get people who are ill, really ill, for example, they could have cancer or something, and even so, when they're well enough, or if, you know, they're still contributing to that distro, be it packaging or testing or whatever it is, and it's kind of, you know, some of the people that, sometimes it's like, why are they doing that? Why are they doing it? And they're doing it because they think it's a good cause, and it's, you know, it's a good cause, and that's why people do. And, you know, it's kind of impressive. People are giving up. They're doing things that I guess wouldn't really happen in the case of closed source software normally, because of how it's made. But in the case of open source, it can happen. You can get all these interesting people involved with these projects, and that's what I think is. From different walks of life, as I think the saying goes, and that's what I think is really good about open source as well.
Yeah, I've always said that, you know, a group of dedicated, you know, dedicated being a nice way to put the way that some people are fanatic about, you know, creating software, or just the kind of general. Yeah, you know, they work at like a feverish pace. You know, like the software's gonna run away from them if they're not, you know, if they don't get it done.
Oh, and yeah, totally.
That really only happens here because, you know, in the proprietary world, you know, people are working for a check. And yeah, you'll get some fanatics, and you know, but even those people, it's seen as a kind of weird thing for them to be that fanatical about it, where, you know, on our side, we're just like, hey, you gave up 14 hours of sleep to work on this? Cool beans.
Yeah, exactly.
There's almost like an artisan quality to open source software. It's, you know, it's done by people who love it, who, you know, for, you know, their own uses, and it happens to be useful to others and things like that.
Yeah, but and not just the development though, or packaging, but the I'm a good example in a way of like this. I mean, less technical contributions can add up and lead to different things or result in different things. So, for example, I decided, like I said earlier, I think that I'm going to join the marketing team. And then I got into, and then I became a deputy leader of the team, and I thought, wow, for a few mailing list votes, but yeah, all that. And then I went to an event with a talk, and then I went, and then we got into the lug eventually, and should have gone earlier, but on the other hand, I think I went at the right time to go to the lug, so I knew about it for about 2 years before I even went. And then the lug resulted in finding about this event I talked at, because I was on the mailing list, and then and then something else happened. I instead of lug meeting actually on that day, and then I ended up finding about another group for like speaking and stuff, public speaking, and you know, it's, and so I'm now going to this other group, and sometimes, and it, you know, it's all linked, isn't it? It's all linked. It's all kind of linked to the whole tech interest and stuff. But it's just kind of like it changed my life because it's like. Because I went with Geo, and then that linked to that, and then that linked to this, and then a link to that, and yeah, and that I think is interesting as well, and it's all part of fun, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, it's never bad for a CV when you walk into the place and you say, "So I've been working either with or on the open, you know, open source software and the community that's involved for X number of years." You know, employers really kind of look at that like, oh, that's pretty big.
Yeah, but I think it's, but for the less technical contributions, I think it can be a bit harder because it's like I said, marketing or promotion or whatever it is, you know, because you can't say, look, I contribute to this code and this is my code or something like that. But maybe you've done a speech or something, you can obviously have a video of it, and or, for example, and but that's the other thing. My other point I want to make is a lot of the time I think people kind of ignore the, or isn't taken that seriously. They think, right, software, even open source, you know, think, right, software is about code, it's about or packaging in the case of Linux. But what people forget at times, or a lot of the time actually, is that actually open source or free software is a lot more than just code and packaging and the technical stuff, because there's a whole, for a start, you kind of need your marketing side, because what's the point of having all this the so-called great software if hardly anyone's using it for a start? So you need somebody to kind of promote and get it out there, but if, you know, for the, otherwise it's kind of like, who's going to use the software? And then also a lot of projects, maybe not the Linux kernel as such, but you know, they need artwork, or if we're a distro, they need the background or branding and icons. Why the projects need this and that, so artwork is part of it as well. It's less technical contribution. A good one that gets ignored though a lot of the time is documentation. People ignore documentation, or they don't really take it that seriously. So so obviously the great example here is, well, for a start, you've got a lot of programs, you can read the man page, you name the terminal, but the website documentation tends to be lacking. Actually, Majira is a bit of an interesting one for this, because now there is a docs team, and a few people, whoever it is, but they do a really great job at what they actually do, but sometimes it's a bit like documentation is still lacking because of whatever, but on the wiki anyway. But they're doing a great job at what they actually do. But my point was, in general, documentation is sort of ignored. People think, we don't need to have all this documentation for Linux, for these open source projects because of whatever, or maybe because they think, maybe you can figure it out themselves and all the rest of it. But sometimes you do need documentation because, for example, there was somebody, whenever it was now, early on the New Year show, he was talking about a technical program, I think it was, something, he was going to do something quite technical, and he needed some documentation, but it was all lacking, you know, and he had to figure out things for himself too much, and we couldn't do what he wanted because of the documentation was lacking. Even when it comes to something basic as, I had to figure out how to make a remaster of Majira more recently because of this event thing. Anyway, so I thought, you know, Majira is a distro that is, it's not really, it doesn't really get remastered. So actually, do you know what a remaster is? Well, I mean remaster, of course.
You mean like a re-spin or a remix, that kind of thing?
Yeah, basically take the official ISO and then add in whatever packages you want. So it could be codecs, it could be programs that average people want pre-installed and so on. So, so I was like, so they wanted remasters for this event. So, I had to basically figure out how to make a remaster. Otherwise, my thing would, not be in push all, basically, as one of the chosen distros and so on. So, I realized hang on a minute, I've never actually made a remaster for any distro before, not even the so-called distros that more commonly get remastered or whatever, like Ubuntu and things like that. And so I pretty much realized, I pretty much found out straight away, I don't think I'm going to be able to remaster this one, or not so easily, because there's no, so I realized there won't be the documentation, probably not. So I spent some time in November trying to figure out how to make a remaster, and it got frustrating at times, because when it came to the other distros that were wanted and so on, it was easy enough. You just typed it in into Google or whatever, and it came up with info, but not for this one. So I had to so I went to IRC and I went on to mailing lists and I sort of asked if anyone had to remaster it. I went to IRC as well. There was somebody who replied, and he made a nice guide for remastering it using a program, but not the like official program or whatever. Anyway, so I did all that. I made something and so on, and then eventually, because I'd done this discussion and this discussion happened, somebody decided to move out. There's an old guide on one of the Mandriva sites, and that was out there. I didn't know at the time, but anyway, that somebody decided to move that over, so because of the discussion. And so that's just one example. And when I was looking it up, actually, there was nothing really out there. Nothing came up. It was just an old form thread from 2011. Like, somebody said, like, I really like Magia. How do I remaster it? And, it gets a bit... that's just an example I'm using, but this would apply to lots of things. It can get a bit frustrating if the documentation isn't after there. Isn't just out there. And sometimes it's for things that you kind of think, you know what? There should be this documentation. It should be easy available. But it's not. Because no one has bothered or whatever to make a page about how to do this particular thing, and that's can be a bit frustrating, and that's why documentation is important. And also last year, 2013, I found out that there was a guy who came to our documentation team mailing list for Magia, and he basically said, we got an event in America somewhere for people who are doing open source documentation, and you're invited to come along if you can come along, basically. And I saw this email and I thought, that is pretty interesting, that there's actually a specific event for open source documentation. Now, you wouldn't expect that, would you? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. I don't know that I wouldn't not expect it. I mean, seems like the kind of thing that's going on all the time in the open source community.
Yeah, we've got some people coming back here. We had Verbal, Verbal I haven't seen before. And also I see Popey's back now as well. Oh. But yeah, documentation is important in can be, my point. Because otherwise you need documentation for these programs, or it doesn't really work, or people get problems and they can't use the program in certain cases even. But if no one makes that documentation, then suddenly you get the issue, right? Or if the documentation is out there, but it's not really in a place where people are going to find it in certain cases, then there can be that as well. Welcome back, Popey.
What's up, Verbal?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well. Happy New Year's.
Same to you.
Yeah, it's still going on.
So anything exciting coming up in 2014?
Not too much. In about another week or so, well, January the 11th, I'm going to take the second part of my LPIC test. So wish me luck on that.
Oh, cool, dude, cool. So are you doing this for fun or for work?
Mainly just for fun because, you know, I think I'm pretty, you know, I've been using Linux for a long time, but I don't really have like any certifications or anything like that. So I says, hey, well, I might as well just go for it because you never know, you know, if I apply for something, you know, they might say, okay, well, what do you know? And I'll just say, hey, here's my certificate. I mean, it's just easier that way, I guess.
Yeah, I was telling Seeb, there's three of them.
Seb.
Seeb. That just being involved in this community can help you get a job. Yeah, he had made a delineation between, or he had made an assumption that I meant that being involved in this this community meant being involved with just coding. But yeah, when I got my job, I told them, yeah, I've been involved with the free software community for 10 years. And they were like, oh, cool. And I go, yeah, and I'm also involved in this project and this project and this project. I didn't tell them whether I could code or not. I just told them I was involved, and they were, you know, they were impressed. And it's probably one of the reasons why I got the job. So, having a certification makes that even easier.
Oh, yeah. I've been involved with Linux for about 10 years. Saying that, there's a place in the... I'm thinking of possibly... Well, I'll see if I can do something for them. If I can do something there, because they use Linux at this place, and they do some networking stuff and so on. So it could be interesting to see if I could get involved with that.
Yeah, I think that's a lot what a lot of people assume. They says, oh, okay, well, if you're going to be doing Linux or something, you're always going to be like coding. But that's not really, you know, that's not really always the case. I mean, you know, you could be like a LAN administrator or something like that, or, you know, running a mail server. I mean, there's tons of different, you know, places where you can fit in.
We can do some promotion stuff or whatever, or you just do it as a hobby or, but yeah, that's kind of what I was saying earlier. There's all these different aspects, and you know, there's marketing, there's promotion, there's artwork, there's translation, there's documentation, there's all these different aspects. But what I also said earlier basically is that what happens a lot of the time, what seems to happen anyway, is that the other aspects of an open source contribution or, you know, the less technical contributions, they kind of get ignored. It's kind of like it's all about the technical stuff, or at least the jobs seem to be. You know, there aren't really any jobs in marketing of promotions of an open source projects, and there's not really there's probably not really any graphics design jobs when it comes to like, right, we're going to use GIMP and we're going to make open source graphics, or, you know, or translation, or
yeah, don't say that to anyone that works at Red Hat or Canonical or anything like that, because those people would be very upset to find out that their jobs don't exist.
Maybe Canonical and Red Hat, sure, there will be some of these jobs, I'm sure, as well. But, and I mean, like, in general, it's kind of like there aren't really these jobs out there. It's kind of all stuck on the technical, the server admins and the network admins and things like that. And that's kind of a shame, really.
If you have a, you know, if your schooling is in marketing, because that's what they're looking for marketers, is do you know, yeah, did you go to school for marketing? Then if you go, oh, and I've also done marketing for this, you know, for this Linux distribution for like 5 years, you know, while I was going to school, I was also working on this. Here are some of the things I did while I was there. That will raise you up a bar, you know, above the other candidates, because you've already been doing the thing you want to do.
Well, yeah, or sometimes, like, even if you didn't get, saying that, even if you didn't get your degree in computer science or marketing or whatever it is, right, maybe you've been doing something linked to the interest to do with open source or whatever, and then you still get into the job or whatever it is. But, you know, it depends, doesn't it? Because, but yeah, you don't necessarily need a degree to get the so-called dream job or whatever you want to call it. And the other point to that actually is that even nowadays, even if people have a degree in whatever it is, they're not necessarily going to get a job in that because of the how many other people are trying to get a job in that and so on, you know.
Well, it's all about skills. And if you've been doing something and you have product to show, you obviously have a skill. Someone coming out of school, they might have a portfolio of assignments they worked on, but it's not, you know, those assignments really aren't tangible assets. You know, if you say you're doing graphic design. Okay, well, I was on the art team for Food Distro, and I worked with a small team of about 5 people and came up with this entire the scheme for this entire user interface. Here are some screenshots. Check this out. That's a portfolio.
Well, yeah. You could say you did this and that for this distro and put that in somehow, if that's what you mean as well.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're getting to the point where almost everyone has a degree. Like, there are people flipping burgers at McDonald's that have a 4-year degree. They're becoming kind of, you know, passe. Everyone has it. But at the same, you know, there are certain industries that are going, yeah, look, this degree thing is not that big a deal. IT has kind of always been one. But, you know, working with the open source community, you gain skills.
Yeah, that was my point.
Even as a hobbyist, though, you don't even have to be involved with a distribution. Just as a hobbyist, there are so many opportunities for you to do weird things with your computer that you'll start to do them,
yeah,
and you'll get help from your friends. So, I mean, how many Linux nerds do you know that have like a like seriously complicated home network setup? Yeah, they've got a basement full of servers, and you know they're running 4 or 5 websites off of it, all because they needed something to do. Yeah, it's not that you know they thought, oh, I can turn this into a job someday. They were like, man, I sure do want to run my own mail server because Gmail kind of sucks.
But yeah, anyway, that was my point, because I think I said it earlier, that's the thing with open source free software, what I'm going to say, is that it can open up so many different opportunities to people, depending on person. You can get involved with this and that, and it just could then lead off to something else, and this is really open to anyone really who wants to get involved, which is the nice thing about the whole thing as well. I mean, obviously you need your skill or whatever, and you've got to decide what you're going to do, but you know, it's kind of like open to everyone, people including people who don't have their so-called IT degree or whatever it is, you know, and it's there for them as well to get involved if they want to do that and do their thing. And that I think is a great thing. And of course now with the whole internet thing and all the rest of it, it can be a big global international thing as well, which is interesting as well.
So the thing that people have to realize is I'm a third time college dropout. The furthest I got was in a degree in psychology. And I got an entry level job. I mean, it's entry level, but I'm being paid fairly well for it. I got a job in the IT industry because I had a certain set of skills that they needed. You know, they needed someone who would look at a problem and hack on it. And it's like, well, I've been hacking on things for about a decade now. Cool. Let's do this. Give me money, and I'll make weird magic happen.
Well, yeah, that's basically what I was saying as well. You can drop out and you can still get involved and become whatever you become, you know, sort of thing.
See, now I'm not telling people to drop out of college, you know, unless that's the thing. Unless that was already happening.
No, I wouldn't say to drop out. But I'm saying, what my point was that you don't necessarily need a degree anyway to become whoever you're going to become when it comes to open source, or it could be other things as well. But you know, it depends too, with like who you are, what life opportunities you got, and where you are as well, but and stuff like that. But and even possibly who you know and things. But that's how it is, isn't it?
Well, the important thing is whatever you want to do later on, start doing now. You don't have to be paid for something to do it.
Just start doing it. Yeah, that's why I do some of the Magia stuff. I'm not getting paid to do whatever I do with any of this Magia stuff, but it's what I wanted to do. So, you know, that's why I do it here and there.
But, I have a lot of friends that are artists, and I tend to steal things from them because, for some reason, standing in a room with paint fumes tends to make people really deep. They always say, you don't become a great artist because you hid from life for 4 years to get a degree in art. You become a great artist by spending 4 years not having to deal with the real world and doing whatever your art is.
All right, yeah. Same with a lot of the computer stuff. You don't really become a great programmer or whatever it is if you're just doing a course. So you have to kind of, you know, have to experiment at home, don't you, and try things out for yourself, or in general, I guess.
A lot of the big computing breakthroughs in the last 30 years have come from people who were working on their doctorate in computer science and thought, man, if only I could do foo and bar easier, my dissertation would almost write itself. And so they worked on foo and bar and then went, oh my God, I could make millions of dollars doing this. Screw my degree, and they started a company.
Yeah, but also, and then the other kind of like a side point to that is that the other thing could go with your thing sort of is that obviously now with the internet and all these open source tools that are out there, it could be server tools, it could be whatever is needed really. You can pretty much start your own business, and you can start. You know, the software is out there. You can start. You can use it to, start different projects or maybe a business, and to help you do that. You know, isn't that pretty much what happened with Google, wasn't it? Or apparently,
yeah. Say, Verbal, as a proper adult, what do you think of all this?
Well, I think it's true. I think I got into Linux because I thought it was interesting. I've always liked computers, and I never really got into it saying, oh, wow, I'm going to, make all this money. And it was just something that I liked. I've been using computers since, I don't know, about like 85, I think it was. And it just through the course of just using them and learning about them, and people would say, well, we need somebody that can do this. And I'm like, yeah, I can do that. And it's just been, that's how it's been,
What about, actually, Popey, if you're still here, how did you get into the whole, Ubuntu and so on stuff? I wonder.
I was using Linux for a few years before Ubuntu came along, and I started off with Red Hat, I think, before Fedora existed. And I was having trouble with RPMs, and one of the guys in my local Linux user group said, oh, you should try Debian, it doesn't have those problems. And so I switched to Debian. He was right. And then a couple of years later, I was having a problem with Debian, and he said, maybe you should take a look at Ubuntu, it looks quite cool. And that was just as it had been announced in 2004. And so I looked at it, and I downloaded the ISO and installed it. And that was it. I've used Ubuntu pretty much exclusively since 2004. And then I think in 2006, I started doing answering loads of support questions on Launchpad. And it got to the point where I'd answered so many of these support questions that I'd clocked up more karma, the karma points you get in Launchpad for everything. I clocked up more karma like by an order of magnitude than any of the developers who'd actually made the product, and that was just through me answering support questions. Then I got more involved in the community, and eventually 2 years ago I got a ping from Mr. Shuttleworth, and he said, would you like to come and work for us? And I said yes. So yeah, simple as that.
Yeah, that's similar to my story. Well, we'll start a bit. Because I started off with Fedora Core 2. Somebody like introduced me from school into the whole open source thing in 2003. And then, you know, I was still on a family computer. I was 17, so 2004. And then I got 17 still. And I got an old family computer. And then pretty much straight away, I realized, you know what? Okay, it's my computer now. I can do whatever I want. So I downloaded the ISOs for Fedora Core 4. Fedora Core 2. I just downloaded the ISOs. This friend, this guy, he knew Slackware, but he never really told me what distro to use. He just said, no, you have to pick your own distro. So I picked between Debian and Fedora Core 2. Fedora 1 because it basically said it was all free on the site, and so I thought free as in price. I didn't mean about the software freedom stuff or as such just yet. So I downloaded the full ISOs, put it on my computer, old computer, 128 megabyte RAM, and it took like 4 hours to install, and then I couldn't use it online because I didn't have this, I wasn't hardwired, and I had this wireless device my dad put in, and I couldn't get that using working with Linux. So I had to use XP for internet for a while, and then and Linux for like other stuff like OpenOffice and so on, and but then I was going to work for somebody possibly, and I needed a better internet connection, so I got hardwired, and that meant. And then, but thing is, because I was new, and this is the days when things were a bit more complicated than they are now. So when Grub went wrong, that basically meant that I had to reinstall the whole thing because I didn't know how to fix Grub. I'm sure some of you remember these days as well, and So I skipped Fedora Core 3, put Fedora Core 4 on, and that was on there for a while, but then things went wrong again, and then I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to do the whole flower install thing again and all that. But then somebody else from school, he basically said to me, you know what, because it's 2005 now, so he basically said to me, you should try out this Ubuntu, it's quite popular, it's quite good, and it's, so I put on the first Ubuntu, the second release for Ubuntu. And I used that quite happily until around 2009, sometime in 2009, let's say. And then things moved, I started looking at more other distros and so on again, and so on from there, really. What about the other two, if they're still here? If we're doing the how did we get into Linux thing, sort of ended up on that.
Well, I started with Linux back in 98, 99 with Slackware.
Yo, Cobra's turned up. What happened to 330 and Rebel?
I killed them.
I'm still here. I'm back from the dead.
Dang zombies.
Say, Cobra 2, what are you doing? Canadian New Year isn't for like another 3 weeks, is it?
I have a headache.
I don't know what that has to do with time, but... Okay.
It has nothing to do with time. It has to do with what I was doing last night while I was on the show.
Ah. So, do you get to celebrate two New Years? Is your wife okay with that? You get to celebrate American New Year and then Canadian New Year?
I think they're the same thing, isn't it, based on time zone?
Well, you guys screwed up Thanksgiving, so you guys, Canadians, don't know when Thanksgiving is either.
Yeah, don't let me in with that stupid crew.
We don't lump you in. Geographically, you're Canadian now.
Yeah. Do you speak Celsius?
Do I speak who what?
Celsius.
No, I'm a proper American.
All right. This place where I'm going is minus 30 Celsius yesterday. So it's freaking cold.
Hey, man, you're the one that moved to the Great White North.
Emphasis on great and white. But I don't know about the New Year's thing, man. I don't really give a flying flip.
You're like, yay, another reason to drink in the middle of the week.
Absolutely.
Keeps you from being an alcoholic.
And a drug addict.
Sorry, New Year's a reason to podcast, it seems, isn't it? For us, anyway.
Yeah, I do about one podcast a year. It usually lasts about 6 hours.
I think 3:30's been doing one for about 6 hours now, actually, seriously. Or was it five, or whenever we came on, about 5-6 hours, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
So, as soon as you got to work.
No, you think I'm working on New Year's Day?
Shame on you.
I am white and middle class. That shit ain't happening.
You should be a money-grubbing whore.
I tried to be, but I just really can't care that much about paper that has no real value.
That's why you get hashes that have no real value. And trade them for paper that burns.
First day back at work tomorrow. Yay!
I go back Friday.
I have to be back tomorrow. Although the 2 weeks between Christmas and New Year's, I was quote-unquote working from home.
Nice. Get paid for that working from home?
Uh-huh.
Sweet!
I'm salary, so they pay me the same amount, just broke up throughout the year, so whether I work or not, they pay me.
Back at Chronicle Paper, maybe it's not quite like Google. Apparently Google's got all these nice offices, isn't it? But what's Chronicle like?
We mostly work from home. Yeah, I mean, we've got offices, but I almost never go into the office.
Yeah, only when you need... Brome works at an office, but he does like 80% of his work from home.
You only go into the office when you need human contact?
I think yeah, he only goes in for meetings.
You're like, I'm starting to talk to myself. Maybe I should go into the office.
Yeah, I already talk to the cats too much.
See, it doesn't work for me. My office is in the... So I work for two seminaries. And so all of the administrative people and all of the professors are in these two buildings. And I work in a completely separate building that just has a computer lab and classrooms in it. So even when I go into the office, I'm completely by myself. I've thought about starting like a Google Plus hangout and just being like, hey, people, come talk to me for the love of God.
Could be fun, maybe.
So I've got two hard drives in this laptop, and at the moment it boots. One of them has got Ubuntu on it, and the other one's got Windows on it. But I've realized that I never really use the Windows partition, the Windows disk. So I'm thinking I'll wipe it, yeah, back up anything I need, wipe it, and then... I'm not sure what to do with it then.
Gen 2.
You could dual boot with some other distro.
No, I don't. I don't want to dual boot. I want to use it as part of the storage of my Ubuntu system. I just don't. I'm not quite sure what the best strategy for that is.
Oh right, yeah.
Did you use LVM to create your? Are your partitions part of an LVM?
No, it's just. Yeah, one giant ext4 partition.
You could make that into, you can make a home partition or just resize it or something like that.
The problem with that is that I've already got home on the first one, and these two drives are both the same size. They're both 240 gig.
Yeah, so, but you just copy everything that's in your home drive now to the new drive, and then mount the new drive where home is.
Right, I'm okay with actually doing it, but I'm not quite sure on the value of doing that, given the vast majority of my space is in home. So all I'm doing is moving from one drive to another.
Or you could just keep home and then have your other drive as an additional data partition or something.
Yeah, I could mount that somewhere under home, I guess, and put all my like work stuff or something in there. I don't know. That's what I was trying to figure out, where would be the best place to mount it.
I usually just throw all my extra drives in. I think Soundy finally cut me off.
I think the recordings are going through. I hope so anyway.
Well, it was a 6 hour long recording, so it was time to actually restart it.
Well, yeah, 6 hours.
So this is no longer the 26-hour podcast. It's now up to, like, what, 40-some?
32. 26 plus 6.
Why don't we just keep it going? Like, people just keep rotating in and out, and we'll see if we can, you know, how far into 2014 we can go.
Who has no life? I do.
Yeah, you could carry on, but actually, I assume it will like kind of die out later on tonight, UK time or something like that, or American time because of some of you in different time zones, something like that. But then you have to stay on for another 6 hours just because you said that 3:30.
I don't have to do anything. I don't recognize any authority, let alone yours.
I'm figuring I'll probably die out sometime tonight, but again, let me guess, probably another somewhere between 6, 8, or 9 hours, somewhere in there.
Yeah, it could be if people carry on chatting and stuff.
I'm trying to like bring a big enough group in from IRC to get them talking so that I can leave.
Yeah, good luck bringing those recluses in here.
5150 is back in IRC.
Yeah, I saw that earlier.
He's had like 4.5 hours of sleep at this point, yeah, I think.
But it might have just been the computer, though, just reconnecting or something, or don't know quite.
No, because he mentioned that he was actually back.
Oh, right, I see.
I've had all of 6 hours of sleep.
So I was sleeping well till you people rudely awakened me at 7 a.m.
And 5150, we apparently let him sleep too late, he said.
if he'd stayed asleep the first time, he wouldn't have slept late.
But hell, 6 hours ago, he was on here drunk as a skunk.
Yeah, and that before was, that, he was asleep.
I was going to say, that was after he passed out the first time going to get a beer.
Yeah. I like having that guy around. No matter how out of control my drinking could ever get, I wouldn't be able to beat him. Makes you feel good about yourself.
You could probably handle your drugs a little better.
Well, I got this really nifty carrying case for him.
Ba-dum-tsh.
If this lasts another, make that just under 6 hours, right? If it lasts that long, well, we'll have the whole of the 1st of January in UTC, GMT, in the UK, so that's kind of something, because that's sort of the middle time zone, or, okay, just 14 hours ahead and 12 back now, but anyway, that would be something.
Yeah, we could win some kind of awards, useless.
If we did 12 hours, we'd have all of the U.S. Midwest done. Then another 2 hours to finish up to the West Coast. So another, 8 hours-ish to finish up all the U.S.?
There's no way I'm sticking around that long. These headphones hurt my head way too bad.
You want to do 8 hours? Did you say 8 hours? It's probably smaller than that, isn't it? I'm talking about midnight at the end of whatever time zone, but
did I say 8 hours? I'm at 14 hours.
Do you want to do 14 hours? Seriously?
I didn't say I wanted to do 14 hours. I just said I'm talking about 14 hours to get all of the U.S. in.
If it so happened to happen.
I think it could happen as long as somebody keeps on at least 2 people any one time.
As long as there's somebody more interesting to talk to than 3:30, I'm game.
I don't know. My milkshake seems to bring all the boys to the yard.
Yeah, too bad it don't bring the girls.
Okay, wait a second. I'm going to take that back. Because you'd have to actually go all the way to 6 a.m. my time, 6 a.m. Central, tomorrow morning to get all of America in.
No. That leaves out L.A. still, doesn't it? That's 8 hours behind, isn't it? Oh. Yeah, that would leave L.A. out, wouldn't it? Los Angeles, California.
No, because I'm looking at the last time zone that we just went through, and the last time zone is some small region of the U.S., Baker Island and Howland Island. So that was 6 a.m. in the morning today. So that's when I actually got up and left after we got done.
Oh, you said your time, not my time. That's right, yeah. Your time.
Yep, my time. Which would be, it'd be basically GMT 1200.
Well, yeah. That would be something, actually. It'd be like 2 days.
If we really had to fill up 2 days, Cobra 2 and I would have to talk about Pegwell's one shirt OLF.
You might need to get 5150 on an intravenous feed of booze.
Or we could talk about LTM.
You heard that I actually got a reference to that in
a okay. It's just sad that y'all laugh at that just from the acronym.
I can see all the pictures in my head.
I bet you they look cool on acid.
Okay, so what is this? LTM?
LTM.
A dear friend of ours had a website dedicated to him by Dan Washko that was sometimes sexually suggestive.
Okay, I got it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's that infamous phrase around the
dang, Soundy, go to bed.
I just got up, man.
Me too.
I slept for 6 hours.
5150 just time traveled.
No doubt.
He was like, 1 minute I'm in the kitchen, the next minute I'm on my face in the living room, and 6 hours passed. I've time traveled before.
Well, I did make it to the... This is pretty much accurate.
Oh my gosh, Dan updated it.
Is it back?
It's bad. Don't look at it at work.
I'm looking at it, and I'm not even using incognito mode, because I'm a badass.
And that'll be on your headstone. He was a badass.
He looked at Lemon Tuna Mouth and didn't give an S. I still love that front picture. God, that's funny.
Yeah, if you stop there, it's still funny. Other than that, it's just scarring.
Man, this hasn't been updated. These are all old.
Really? Because the last ones I saw were, like, psychedelic.
Yeah, I'd done all the psychedelic ones. I'm so glad this is back online.
You have a new homepage?
Yep.
Swine flu at OLF.
Actually, onto something that has substance.
I'm looking for something completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking for a tool, preferably in C++ or something.
Need
not
a tool.
Java,
look no further than Pegwall, biggest tool on the planet.
I'm gonna stab you in the eye with a soldering iron.
So you're looking for something written in C++.
Yeah, that just downloads RSS feed and pulls all the attachments off of them.
Best thing out there is Bashpotter, actually, and that's a Bash script.
But I don't want to pull down podcasts and stuff. Will Bashpotter work for any attachment?
Any attachment that's an enclosure, I think. I don't know if it would do any, like, you're talking about any reference, like, web page or anything like that, probably not. No.
No, not necessarily a web page, but it might just be a link to like a torrent file or NZB file.
And why does it have to be in C++?
Because C++ is fast.
Actually, your limiting factor there is your internet connection more than anything else.
No, my limiting factor is RAM.
I just seen it. Yeah. There's a the free new New Year's channel just... Well, yeah, I got kicked out of there just over 2 hours and a bit ago, 4 o'clock UK time. But that's everyone, though. So, yeah, it's everyone free new New Year's, but we could carry on here. But I don't know if anyone went in there. Probably not. It was just kind of like a very kind of floody, spammy with TechStart or ACSI or whatever it's actually called, stuff like that. But yeah, it's still New Year's, kind of, so we can might as well carry on with this.
Yeah, it's New Year's Day here, so...
Yeah, exactly, it's New Year's Day. But the Freenode one is over, that was my point. Until next year.
Well, that sucks.
We're still going strong.
Yep.
Like, I found an RSS reader called NewsButer, but it doesn't appear to have any, auto-downloading capabilities. It just queues up stuff. I'm trying to run this on a router, so that's why Python's not going to work.
Why don't you just write one?
I'm no good with that, man.
Well, that'll give you something to do.
Well, I'm about to be working 12 and 16-hour days. About all I'll be doing is work, sleep, eat.
All right, we're up to 8.5 gig of recording now, but I still have 200 gig of available without expanding my file system.
Wow, really? Eight gigabytes. Yeah, quite a bit.
8.5, and that's all in FLAC.
Hey,
oh,
in FLAC,
that explains it, because that's the bigger files than ODD and MP3, because apparently the quality is better. But I don't know, does anyone actually notice the difference between like different file formats or sound, seriously? Because to me, music is pretty much music on whatever I listen to on when it comes to that.
Oh, I know the difference for music stuff, but for voice stuff like this, man, it's a little bit better than a telephone, so not really. The only reason to use FLAC here is because it's easier in terms of editing, getting it into Audacity and that, because it doesn't have to expand it as much, so it doesn't use as much memory.
Oh, right, yeah, that probably makes sense, because the file's already quite big, but it's got all the quality in there. Is that what you mean as well?
Yeah, it's only about 10-15% smaller than a raw WAV file, so it's not that much, not too small, so it doesn't actually have to do as much decompression.
Yep. Are you putting the thing together, or is Ken doing that, or whatever, or bits of however the recording has parts?
I think Ken's doing it right now, but as I said, keep my recordings just in case.
Yeah, well, you need the backups when you could go wrong and lose it all.
Well, he told me to keep my recordings even once I see the episodes start coming out next week.
Although on your name here, it doesn't say recording, but you're on another one, I assume, or something.
My name here, it says it has the record light turned on.
Yeah, actually it does. I was looking at the wrong person or whatever. Actually, I was looking at myself by the looks of it, but yeah, yours is fine.
Hey, speaking of podcatchers, what is everybody using now? I have been using Beyond Pod for a while, and I really like it on my phone, but I think I want to try something new just to see what it's like. Instead of distro hopping, I'm going to be podcatcher hopping.
I'm using GPodder.
BashPodder all the way.
I use MashPodder.
I'm not really listening to enough podcasts or special podcast software, or not at the moment, because I tend to prefer music listening on the computer and so on. But I should be playing this in Clementine, I expect, even though I'm actually a GNOME user, so I like GNOME 3, but Clementine is a music or audio player. It seems to be quite nice. And then there's loads of nice players, really, when it comes to that. But yeah, Clementine is good enough. But saying that, I never really, years ago, it would always be kind of like, oh, no, you should go and use Amarok, not Rhythmbox, because Amarok is better, or at least KDE people would say that. But with Amarok, I never really got into that. I never really liked Amarok, but I think Clementine is based on Amarok as well, or something like that, or forked from it, maybe even.
If you're going to be worried about what people say about your music players, you should at least get berated by people that are doing something different. Like if I said Amarok, you should be using CMuse.
What's that one?
G Music Browser all the way, baby.
MPD.
CMuse is a Incurse's terminal application for managing playlists and stuff.
You don't use Beats?
I don't like Beats, they're gross.
You got someone else in the channel by the looks of it. Some sort of Chris person, it seems, whoever that is. But yeah, come join. Oh, there you are. Come join in. Yeah. What was that? Sorry.
I'm from Jupiter Broadcasting Colony.
Oh, right.
Your volume's a little low, bud.
Is that better?
Not at all.
A little bit better. We can bring it up more.
We're doing 48 hours or something like that, apparently. Now.
Is this Chris from the Linux Action Show?
No. Not even close. By the way, my volume is set up all the way.
Yeah, you sound like you're low, but we can hear you.
You sound like you're calling from Jupiter.
Well, maybe I am.
Well, then maybe that's friggin' awesome.
Well, then you're not really Chris USA, are you?
I'm Chris USA in Jupiter.
There's a USA in Jupiter?
Yeah. Didn't you know that?
It's right in the middle of that big storm.
It's right by the big red dot.
It actually really explains Pegwool.
It does.
Chris actually lives in the East Coast. Chris, that does a Linux Action Show. I live in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah? What part of the Midwest?
Utah.
Okay. See, I'm from Chicago, so I would just consider, for me, Utah would be west.
Yeah, it's about as west of the Midwest as you can get.
All right, whatever. I don't know. I just call it Midwest because, I don't know, whatever.
Is that in, which time zone is that? Is that in Central or Mountain?
Mountain.
Okay, definitely yeah. West.
Man. You're west.
Okay.
Mountain's that's cool. Which,
you're talking to a bunch of... Sorry, you're talking to a bunch of people.
Time zone, is that... The Mountain time zone, what's that? Is that the, like, 7 hour behind UK one? Or I mean, I didn't really know about that one.
Yeah, that's GMT minus 7.
And what about California? What's that one? I mean, it's minus 8, but what's that one?
Yeah, that's minus 8, yeah.
It's Pacific.
Has that got a name as well? Oh, yeah, Pacific. Yeah, Pacific, of course. EST Pacific Mountain. This mountain that I didn't really know about.
EST Central. It goes EST Central Mountain Pacific.
Yeah, it's mountain that I didn't know about. So it's interesting. Well, I mean, I knew the time zone was there, but I didn't know the name. But yeah.
So in reality, Midwestern is more of a feeling than a location. As long as you kind of hate yourself, just a little bit, like just this little bit of self-hatred that you can't get rid of, you've got the Midwest down.
Well, that self-hatred and masochist streak, you know, those two combination right there. Just a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think Slipknot's from the Midwest.
So, random person's from UK or Canada, I can't remember which. Which one are you from, random?
Canada.
You know, that country that never does anything.
Wow.
Except supply a buttload of oil into your country.
Every country does that, though.
Cover it. Earlier you were talking shit about having to live in Canada. Don't be trying to defend them now. You got to choose one side of that border or another.
Oh, no, dude. I straddle that fence.
Cobra, is there still a wild turkey shortage up there?
What are you talking about? I'm the United States, man. I don't have to straddle any border.
No, he's talking to me, bud.
And I said closer.
Wait, there was a wild turkey shortage in Canada?
The bird?
I know there's a shortage in New Brunswick. I don't know about out here.
Is that the bird or the drink?
The booze. That's what I was talking about.
Oh, they brought it back. They got the one with the higher proof that doesn't taste as good.
Typical Canada.
You know,
I can self-register.
My daughter just moved to Canada, so we were going to send her like a birthday gift, and we sent it via, I think it was FedEx. Yeah, FedEx. And even the slowest, shipment was like just this gosh-awful price. And we said, well, don't expect too many things from us, you know, while you're in Canada, because, you know, they wanted us to declare everything on the form and everything. I'm like, this is too much of a hassle, you know. It's terrible.
Yeah, and don't send any more than...
What was that?
What country do you live in?
I live in the U.S. in Chicago, and she moved to Winnipeg.
And how much does it cost to ship to Canada?
It's... I don't know. It was just
the item you had.
It was just a small item. Like, we were going to send her a pair of boots and a scarf and something else. So it's not really a large, heavy package. But it wound up being like $80 through... FedEx.
It's expensive.
Yeah, shipping in Canada is outrageous. Verbal, if you want to send stuff, your best bet is Postal Service, U.S. Postal Service. And try and send small stuff at a value less than, or at a declared value less than $60. And then she won't ever get nailed with customs fees and stuff. UPS has good rates. and FedEx is the fastest. It will always get there on time.
Does Amazon have stores up in the UK? Or, I mean, up in Canada?
Yeah, man, we got Amazon.ca. We even have Amazon Prime without the streaming.
So what I was thinking is if you, next time you could just order it through Amazon.ca and have Amazon deliver it straight to her from there.
That's a good idea.
That way you don't have to pay any shipping. Well, I don't know. It still might be a little bit, but...
You still pay outrageous shipping compared to the U.S.
Even if you order it straight from Amazon and have them deliver to her house?
Unless you have Amazon Prime.
And you have to have UK's version of Amazon Prime, or not UK, Canada?
Yeah, you have to have the Canadian version. If you have the U.S. version, which I have, it doesn't work in Canada.
So how, Cobra 2, how long have you been in Canada?
Just over 3 years now. 3.5.
And what was your biggest shocker that was different from living in the States?
No white gravy.
No white what?
Gravy. White gravy.
Oh, you know? White gravy. I thought you said gravying. I'm like, what the heck is that?
Yeah, it's all brown up here. They don't know how to make white gravy. Where I'm from, if you see brown gravy, that means it's burnt. And it's all runny. It's not nice and thick. And it's like their biscuits are pretty crappy up here, too. They don't know how to make a good buttermilk biscuit unless it comes in a can.
Then it's not good, right? Because it's not homemade.
Oh, Pillsbury's got some pretty good buttermilk biscuits.
What about the cost of living in comparison to when you lived in the States? Is it more expensive?
It's highly dependent on location. Depends on where you are and what you do.
What about your location?
I'm in Calgary right now. Cost of living in Calgary is fairly low.
Lower than where you lived in the United States?
No, it's more expensive than where I lived in the U.S. A higher minimum wage. Minimum wage here in Calgary, in Alberta, is $9.50. Minimum wage back in Georgia is like $7.25, $7.50.
There's some places in Seattle, I was watching on the news, that's raising their minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Yeah, how much is a gallon of milk going to cost there?
I don't know. I don't live there, so I just was watching on the news. Probably $8, $9.
Here, 2 liters of milk, which is roughly 2 quarts, will run you right around $4.
It's 2 liters, or 2 quarts is half a gallon, right?
Yeah, it's a little more than half a gallon.
So a gallon of milk would be like $8 there?
Yeah, it's about $7.50. Pound of cheese is around 13.
That's Canadian dollars versus U.S. dollars, right?
Which is pretty much on par right now.
Yeah, one of the other things that she said that was strange was, I think it may be a good idea, but I guess they had to like pay for their car to be like immigrated, and I guess you have to, you know, winterize your car and everything and get some special block heater and things like that, and It was just going to be like really expensive, and the car, you know, isn't really, you know, I didn't think it was worth it, but
not worth it unless you're buying a brand spanking new car.
Okay,
not worth it at all.
Yeah, but then she finally said she had a friend who would do it for like, you know, 1/3 the price, basically.
Yeah, here in Calgary, they don't have inspections and stuff like that. So if you buy a car, you're good for the first 10 years, and then you have to get a safety inspection. Or if you bring the car in from out of province, or if you bring the car in from across the border in the U.S., then you have to get a safety inspection on it. And that's basically a government mandate that says the mechanic can charge you whatever the hell he wants to and tell you whatever the hell he wants is wrong with the car, and you have to pay it within 30 days.
Oh, that just sounds terrible.
Yeah, there's pretty much little things like that in each province, and each one's different. In New Brunswick, you get a safety inspection every year regardless. it's like an $80 tax every year just to have a car.
That sounds about the same as the U.S.
Well, in Georgia, we don't have those.
I know in Oregon, they don't charge taxes for anything. But once you take your car and move to another state, they charge you tax on that. And, well, I guess they also charge really high rates for land tax.
Yeah, taxes are different for each different part of the country. Like in Alberta, the only province in Canada that's not in debt, taxes are pretty cheap. It's sales tax here is 5%. Property tax is pretty expensive because everything has oil underneath it. And in New Brunswick, taxes are 13% and property taxes are cheap. Income tax is pretty high. I think me making around $30,000 a year, I was paying 25 tax on that. My wife, who makes 60-ish, she pays 52%.
Good gravy.
Socialized healthcare. You still want it?
We're trying to switch to it. It's screwing us over.
It's socialized healthcare is great for anybody who doesn't have a job and doesn't make money and is below the poverty line. Everybody else gets FUBAR'd.
I disagree with that statement in the fact that if I don't want health insurance, it's my choice, not the government's.
You don't have that choice anymore, sir.
Well, I know. I'm just saying that I don't agree with the bottom line of the Democratic Party saying that everyone should have it. It's not something that should be forced, even though now it is. I understand that it is. I'm just saying it should be a choice.
Well, I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that here in Canada, where there is socialized health care, everybody pays for it, except for the people below poverty and the people who don't have jobs, but they still get health care.
See, and here in the United States, I've read stuff that says that if you're in jail, like an actual prison, you're exempt from Obamacare. So now not only do we pay for them live in prison, we have to pay for their health insurance.
All the more reason to push capital punishment. It'd help with that overpopulation in the world thing, too.
I don't think that the world's overpopulated. I think that's a false notion.
There are
areas that are more densely populated than others, but overall, the world is not overpopulated.
Yeah, come to Alberta, you'll find out just exactly how unpopulated the world is.
You know,
well, Texas,
heard...
you could fit everyone in Texas from the United States in Texas, give them like 2 acres, and still have land left over.
Yeah, I heard
everybody
that on the radio.
In the world.
Yeah, I heard that on the radio recently. So, yeah, why is everybody talking about overpopulation, especially in the U.S.?
You could fit the entire population of the world if you put 4 people to a house and give them a quarter acre of land. Basically, turn Rhode Island into a massive subdivision and everyone in the world will fit.
In Rhode Island?
Rhode Island.
That's hard to believe.
4-person household, quarter acre of land?
It seems like Rhode Island's a lot smaller than that.
It is small.
But you're talking 7 billion people divided by 4, which is, what, almost 250 million?
And then divide that by 4 again. That's the acreage you need.
I divide that by 4 is almost 70 million, right? 60 million?
I think it's some like 6.1 million or something like that.
Rhode Island no one could approximately, argue that. Rhode Island's approximately 776,000 acres. So how many did you need?
Let's see. There are 7 billion people. And how many acres?
Rhode Island is 770, we'll call it 777. Thousand.
Multiply that by 4.
Oh, Pokey is back.
Yeah, but not for long. My family, we're heading out, so I was just popping in to stop the recording and say Good day, and thank you to everybody.
Good day, Pokey. Apparently, we might be going for 48 hours now. Apparently.
Well, that's only if we're really crazy enough.
It can be done as long as somebody keeps on chatting. At least two people at any one time. But, yeah, it's quite a lot of hours if that's done.
Now, as long as somebody's still recording, it's really probably the bigger thing.
And the recording as well, of course, yeah.
So that's 3,108,000.
Yeah, yeah. You need 437 million acres, and Rhode Island is only less than a million acres, so that's not correct.
Yeah, it's only 776,000, was it?
777, yeah, if you round up by, like, a few.
Yeah, so you're way short, given hundreds of billions of people in the world.
There's not 100 billion, there's only 7.
All right, guys, well, I'm going to stop my recording and log off here, but thanks to everyone for sticking around and being cool. Yeah, see you guys later.
Come back soon.
Take care.
Now I'm trying to figure out what numbers I had, or where I got the numbers from.
7 billion is 12 zeros, right?
Yes. No. 7 billion is 9 zeros.
Oh, you're stopping recording, are you, Pokey?
Yeah, I already did stop it. I was just thinking, I heard the same thing once, but it wasn't Rhode Island. It was like the Midwest, the Great Basin area of the Midwest. That's what I thought I heard, but I could be wrong, too. All right, I'll see you guys later.
So who we got left now? I think I saw Ken light up as well, actually.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Loud and clear.
Nope.
You're still here?
Oh, I see where I screwed up. It was, if you give everybody 4 square feet to stand, you can fit the entire world's population in Rhode Island.
Oh, 4 square feet.
It'd be like, tight squeeze, everybody move in. Verbal, my friend, how are you?
Some people doing take fine? Up more than 4 square feet.
That was also assuming a world population of 6.6 billion. So I guess you could fit it, but they couldn't live. I'm wrong. You'll never hear that again.
Never let the truth stand in the way of a good story.
If it weren't for those dang numbers, I'm pretty sure I could have argued that one into the ground.
I could have actually gone the other way on you, because I would have said, how much land does it actually take to produce the amount of vegetation or food that would be required to sustain a person?
Depends on what you're eating.
There's for a single year, there's going to be a minimal amount, and it's going to be in the acres. Like, I think for each person, it's probably around 3 to 5 acres of land required to produce enough food for 1 year.
Not even close, man. You can live off of what you can grow in an acre easily. Done it before.
Well, I guess, too, it depends on what you're eating. Are you eating just grains, or are you eating meat? Because then you have to figure out, okay, how much land do I need to feed this cow or these chickens?
If land's at a premium, you're not going to be eating meat. You might have some chickens for eggs, but that's about as close to meat as you're going to get.
Then you also have to consider that what you're going to actually grow on the land, because you can't grow the same thing all the time, year after year, without actually screwing up the vegetation, without actually screwing up the properties of it. So you actually have to rotate things, which then means if you're rotating things, that means other people have to grow different things for you. So you're going to have to keep things going and actually rotating them around, and you're going to have more land that way.
See, they make this awesome stuff now called fertilizer. You usually get it from somebody that grows cows.
And the way you produce fertilizer is you have more land to actually get the cows to actually create that. So you're basically scaling yourself up every step you go.
You guys still going? Camera.
You can grow cows now?
Yeah, I was just thinking, man. That's a new one.
Yeah, that was kind of the argument now. You just had.
What did you say at the beginning, Marcus? Did you go, are you still doing this?
Yeah, he's still doing this. I would have thought you would have finished last night.
It might turn into 48 hours, we're not sure yet, but maybe it kind of just like carried on and on, and
I seriously doubt it.
Me and 3:30 kept it alive about 2 hours early on our own, I think, but yeah,
turning into a proper chat room.
But you know, I didn't chat to anyone from Australia before. That's you, I assume, isn't it? Are you from Australia?
I'm a New Zealander. Yeah.
What? Australia?
Kiwi, different country.
Oh, New Zealand, yeah. Well, sort of the same area, kind of. I'm from, well, you might know where I'm from my accent, maybe.
Yeah, I'm trying to place it, but I'm not there yet.
So good. Well, I'm not American, so...
Yeah, no, I figured that one out. So what have you guys been talking about apart from growing cows?
Just loads of random stuff, I guess, really. Different topics.
William's been very quiet. Sorry, I'll just be the pain. Hey, William. You probably can grow cows now with DNA testing. Haven't they actually done that?
Isn't that called a clone?
Yeah, a clone, yeah. Well, didn't someone come up with mate from a cow that they can actually grow, which can actually make like 150,000 hamburgers or something from one cow?
Well, they have the technology to grow meat, but the whole point was that the supposition was that you could actually fit all the people, all 7 billion people on the earth in a very small space, and that you could actually live, and that wouldn't actually work. Because every step you go, you need more space, more space, more space. So by the time you actually get to a reasonable amount of space to actually grow enough food and have enough resources and, you know, have everything set up for people to actually live, you would actually, I'm guessing you would need at least enough spaces about the size of the U.S. to actually support all 7 billion people in the world, minimally. Yeah,
New Zealand's quite self-supported. I reckon we could have actually survived, actually, if there was a nuclear holocaust and we had to live off the land. Like, our farms are quite well set up, and we've got quite a bit of free space that we don't use, and we're quite self-efficient. We also export quite a bit of stuff overseas, so as far as food is concerned. So we're probably one of the few countries in the world, I think, that would actually survive on our own if we needed to. So our population's not that big compared to our size. So we're about the size of the UK. We've got 4 million. So it's a lot different than the UK is 60-odd.
Okay, so where am I from? Where do you think I'm from?
Oh, you sound like Prick and Pin guy. So I'm picking, I don't know, somewhere in the UK somewhere. I'm having a guess.
Yeah, England. Yeah, so that's the answer.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Like, I reckon Australia would struggle, because Australia haven't got a lot of fertile land. They've got heaps of land, but they haven't got a lot of fertile land. So I think it all depends on how you farm it. And Australia have got a habit of just letting things go and just over a wide range, you know, over a large, to sort of have free range animals, you know, rather than farming, because they can't actually do farming on their land because it's so hot there. So but here we just farm all year round. So you know, you have 300 cows and one lot, and you also most of the farmers will have their own garden thing going on and growing their own food anyway. And then you have I think New Zealand's probably one of the few countries in the world that actually could survive. And also, we're quite isolated, so you also could live off the ocean as well.
Yeah, I guess so.
Also, no one would want to bomb us anyway with a nuclear bomb. It'd be a waste of space.
Is it really hot over there at the moment? Because you've got like summer, haven't you? The opposite to us.
It doesn't really get hot here, but even 20 degrees is quite warm, because we get high humidity. Where the sun sort of burns you, it doesn't really. You don't get hot, but the sun burns.
That sounds like the UK. Like 20 degrees is 20 something is kind of hot, and if it gets 30, that's like a heat wave.
Well, it's 8 o'clock in the morning now, and it's probably 13, 14. It will get up to, it could get up to 30 today. It depends on the, on what sort of day it is and how much wind we have. So, because New Zealand's quite windy overall. And it depends, most of the hot weather comes from up north, so the higher you are, in the island, like in Auckland, they get quite good weather. But the lower you are, like if you go down to Otago, they get really crappy weather. So they probably never see the sun. But I don't know why you want to live down there anyway. But it's all different, really. It all depends on where you are in the country. I'm on the west coast of the North Island, so We get quite a bit of wind, and we've also got a mountain next to us, Mount Taranaki, so we get quite cold air coming off the mountain. But it can get quite warm and humid. You get thunderstorms. You actually get many tornadoes here. It's a bit like somewhere in the US, in the middle of the US, where you get those thunderstorms sometimes.
We don't tend to get any storms here, although there was this kind of storm, beastly-ish, but yeah, I don't tend to get anything too major here.
Oh, we get really random weather. It's like pouring down with rain for about an hour, like really heavy thunder, and be fine for the rest of the day. So we get a lot of flooding and stuff like that. We don't get really a lot of fires and stuff like that, because it's just not, we get too much rain. But this doesn't really, the rain comes and goes, but it's quite random, the weather. We never know what the next day is going to bring, really. The weather forecasters get the weather wrong all the time here.
Have you always lived in New Zealand? Oh.
Yeah, no, I've lived around the North Island, but I've always lived in New Zealand. I think it's a great country to live, really. It's just, I'm here mainly, I'm quite isolated where I am, because my wife wanted to move back to where her family is, and she got a job managing a Burger King store here, so... she was managing one old place where we were, but she quite likes it here, so it's all good. But and it's nice scenery where I am, like with the mountains and stuff, and like, everything's on a freaking hole. But I'm used to like something flat. It doesn't really suit me too much. But I walk a lot, and it's not a big thing. I'm not a big fan of it. We've got the ocean though, which is next to us, which is quite good. There's a nice beach here in New Plymouth, but. It's just, I don't know, it's just different. It's actually like being in a different country to where I used to be from. I'm from a student city, and you know, a couple of universities, and everyone in there used to be a student, same population, but around 60,000-70,000, but most of them were students, and I just found it a lot more easy going. Also, it was a grid city, and it was just quite flat, and year round everywhere, you really didn't need a lot of transport, because you're 40 minutes from one, you know, sort of town to other, and you can just walk everywhere. So I actually found, and the buses were free because they had a lot of students, so I never liked to drive, mainly because of that. So I never really needed to. Here, it's a pain. So I'm 43, so I'm thinking maybe I need to learn to drive.
Yeah. New Zealand is, I don't know, it's one of those places that a lot of people want to go to who, you know, aren't anywhere near New Zealand, so Europe, and I assume America and so on as well. And then and Australia, obviously, as well, for that one. But obviously, it's different living in any of these places that are supposed to be so interesting to meet or something to visit, or apparently.
We're quite modern. Like, people think New Zealand's quite substandard, like third world, but we're a very modern country.
I was wondering that. Well, I was thinking that as well, like you've got cinemas and all the rest of it as well.
Oh, so yeah, I mean, if I wanted to go to the movies, I could go to the movies. If I wanted to buy an iPad, I could buy an iPad. You know, I'm just talking about modern technology. But, you know, we've got shopping centres, we've got, we've got big warehouses and stuff. We've got, the big cities have their big buildings. It's just most of the dwellings in New Zealand are only single-storey houses. Like, we're not really, unless you're quite wealthy. We're in a three-bedroom house, and we're quite happy with the two of us. So we've got native bush surrounding us on top of a hill at the moment. So it's a lot different. There's nothing poisonous in New Zealand. Like nothing can kill you. Nothing, it's not that you have to worry about snakes or spiders or anything. There's nothing really dangerous in the woods either. I mean, the thing that kills most people here is the cold. There's a lot of people die from hypothermia when they go up to the mountains, so they're not prepared for the weather. So that's probably the most dangerous thing here, I think.
Cold can be dangerous in any mountains, really. You know, you go up and you get some bad weather, and then you get possibly stuck on the mountain and all the rest of it.
We get people stuck on the mountain, especially down South Island. Like, there's a whole big, huge mountain range right down the middle of it. And we get people stuck on mountains to go up in their shorts or, you know, shorts and a T-shirt, like, all the freaking time. And they're all tourists. Like, they have no idea. It's just, what's the other thing? Yeah, so it's probably the most dangerous thing here. It's just people just need to be prepared when they do go out to out bush and stuff like that, with the weather-wise. And it's quite hard to keep track of the weather, too.
Have we got anyone else here still? They're going a bit quiet.
That's right, everyone talking. The other thing here, I was talking to Snacky Linux, and he was reckoning he was going to move here one day. He was thinking about 1 year moving to New Zealand, and he goes, I'm not moving here because of the crime rate. But because he read some newspapers. The newspapers here, all they do is just talk about crime, like the crime. They don't talk about anything else apart from crime and sports, and that's about it. So it seems a lot worse than what it actually is. It's more the national, you know, it's not just what's happening in the city, it's like the whole country. So it looks a lot worse than what it actually is. That's probably the worst thing with us. I mean, I think people just get the wrong impression of New Zealand sometimes. We don't have any gun problems. We have no one walks around with any guns or anything like that. So
But UK is pretty much like that as well. It's good that it's some people have guns, but you know it's not really an issue. It's not like America where pretty much anyone can have a gun or whatever. But in fact, there was a gun chat earlier on, but that's been.
If anyone walks, you know, you do every now and again see a nutter walking around with a gun. And the handguns here are quite hard to get too. But they just send the defender squad out who go, you know, located around with them. They just fly out to where the person is, and they're there within a couple of hours, and they just deal with it. So it's just a freaking what they call those like fake guns, you know, they're not proper guns, but just those pay things that people can buy. Can't remember what they're called now, it's gone off the top of my head. That's just normally someone that's mucking around, you know, that doesn't even have a real gun. So, that's probably, and we get murders but stuff, and that makes big news here. Actually, a lot of the people that have committed murders lately have been getting off because of their law system being so tainted towards the defence. They get a good lawyer, and also too, they don't need a lot of money for the defence case, and they can, the government would just pay for it. Basically, if the prosecution spends a lot of money on the court case, then the defence can get that much money as well. So what happens if they hire the best defence lawyers in the country, and they seem to be the only ones making good money at the moment, and they'll get them off on a technicality or something like that. Well, the police do a really bad job in the evidence, and we've had quite a few cases here overturned lately. People that spent 10, 15 years in jail and figured out that the person's just got a good lawyer and got them off on a DNA thing or something else. You know what I mean? It'd be lucky if there's probably one. I think we get 30, 40 murders a year. That. But it's going up, frankly. That's over the whole country. Plus New York, like, they get about that in the night, don't they?
So I didn't hear that.
Saying somewhere like New York or Los Angeles would just have 50 or 60 in a night, wouldn't they?
Oh, you're talking about gun crime. Is that what you're talking about?
Missed some of it. Stuff. We don't get the gun shootings and stuff like that here. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, rarely get stuff like that here as well.
It makes me laugh, though, the American going on about if someone shoots someone, they go, oh, we go and get a gun to defend yourself. I mean, it's just stupid. I just don't get the whole logic. It's all coming from the NSA who just go, it's just all propaganda for them, for people to buy more weapons so they can get more richer and more people die. It's like, I just don't get the whole thing. I just find it quite unbelievable sometimes. I mean, they're talking about putting guns in schools now, with teachers having been armed. That's the most. I couldn't believe that. It's dumb.
Did I see 5150 light up for a second there? Maybe not. We've gone a bit quiet. Who's here, actually? Who's saying a verbal, right?
I'm still here.
I'm here.
So that's most of the people still, then.
I just jumped back in because I didn't hear anything.
I reckon New Zealand
seems lucky.
I reckon New Zealand is one of the most different democratic countries in the world, actually. I really do. We don't get any violence at all to do with our elections. We, pretty much if we want a government out, they only last 3 years, so they will be voted out quite quickly. We have a multi-party system, similar to what Canada has. It's just mainly, we have a wide range of people in Parliament as well. There's not really a lot of things that the members of Parliament can actually do. that the government does, that the public doesn't find out about. So like if something happens, normally the public knows straight away. So they can't really do a lot as far as scandals are concerned. One thing we don't do here is go into private lives of the members of parliament. Like, we don't care if someone's having an affair or someone's gay or someone whatever. We've actually got 8-9 members of parliament that are actually openly gay and got gay partners. It's not a big thing for us. We don't really care. As long as they do their job, it's not a big thing. Religion doesn't come into it here at all. Basically, religion is not mentioned at all. So that's not a big thing. And one thing that people can't do, like advertising, is try and buy a political party and donate funds. They can't donate more than $50,000 to a political party without people knowing about it. And that's what .com got in trouble, actually. Well, not, he got an MP in trouble that he donated $50,000 to. And he became a minister, an independent minister. There's only one MP in that party, and he was helping propping up the government. Because they have a 3-4 seat majority, and they found out that .com donated $50,000 to his campaign. He lied about it, that's a big scandal, and he lost his job over it. So I mean, there's nothing really a lot the politicians can actually do here and actually get away with stuff like they can in the US. But they can't be bought, and they can't be. Normally, if someone's, you know, if they've been paid by someone to say some things, people dig into it and they figure out what's going on quite quickly.
So what would happen if a member of parliament was caught smoking crack cocaine, sort of like Rob Ford from Canada?
They'd just resign. They'd probably be forced to just resign by their own members. We've had quite a few members resign from parliament all the time here, but normally the party just kicks them out. If they embarrass a party really badly, and like the public finds out he's smoking crack, we haven't had that. But it wouldn't surprise me though if someone is actually on cocaine or something in parliament. If that did happen and it did make the news, the party would be so embarrassed about it, they'd just ask that member to resign. And also too, that member would know they'd have no chance of getting into parliament, so they'd probably just quit anyway. A lot of them hang on for the remainder of the term. I've got a couple of people that have left their parties and just independents now, but they never get back in. So they've got like a year left before the next election, and they can't do much, so they just stay out of everyone's way. So it's not a big thing, really. It's public, you know, if you're an independent MP, you don't really get into parliament in this country. You only have to get 5% of the vote as a party to get into parliament. So, and the parliament, the party can select half the members. So their other half gets selected by the public. So you know, just on one off, one against one type thing America does. So, it's very open minded. I think it's a really good system actually. I think the British should change. The London should change. UK should change their political system. I think the first past the post thing doesn't work. I think it's America's problem too. First past the post is just one person running against another person, two parties in parliament, and pretty much they just run everything, and they just do the same thing. You know, it doesn't matter who gets in, and that's what sort of happens. I think that if you have a multi-party system, those two parties can't do what they used to do. They have to give in to the party that's supporting them. So we'll give them some of their, you know, views to the party that's supporting them. So they can't like sell all their assets or, you know, do something they want to do. So that keeps them honest, I think. Now, I think UK's got a sort of multi-party system going under first past the post at the moment, where the government's actually, Cameron's actually been popped up by the Greens, Sebastian. They managed to get like 20% of the vote or something, but they only got like, how many MPs? They've got a huge parliament in the UK.
There's a joint government at the moment, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats.
It's the first time it's ever happened, I think.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I didn't follow it that much, politics, but yeah, probably, or pretty much.
See, if you had a multi-party system, though, they would have got a lot more seats in parliament. Probably would have been the government under a multi-party system, the party that's popping up the government. And that's the thing, they would have had to work with, they could have just worked with someone else. They would have had a lot bigger say. And they wouldn't have been lost in the, you know, in the coalition, because they would have had a lot more say in what's going on. They would have probably another 30, you know, 100 MPs. So that's how that multi-party system sort of works. They would have
there's an election coming up.
It's not multi-party. Like, they've got 20. They got something like 20% of the vote in the last election, or something like 15 or 16%. So if you 15 or 16% of 500 MPs is a lot of MPs. But if you're trying to just win seats one on one, even if you get that large percentage of the vote, you don't get those seats, because you'll put 9 times out of 10 you'll lose against the bigger party, and that's what happens. But we only have 120 MPs here, so it's very. So I reckon the more members you have, the more problems you have.
Although this is going to be an interesting year for Scotland, because I think later on this year they're going to vote for independence, if they want to have independence or not. So if that happens, then the UK will become smaller, I guess, because they'll come to their own country and stuff. But that should be interesting.
They don't want them to leave, because they have all the oil and gas, don't they?
I think that's to do with it partly, but obviously deals can still get done between countries and all that anyway, and I assume so. But that's to do with it to some extent, I think.
I actually think they should leave and go independent. I think that's probably what they... England have treated Scotland really badly over the last 300 years. It's almost like they they pretty much just used them for their own needs, really. Pretty much done the same with us, mainly. Staff at Scotland should just leave and just teach them a lesson, I think.
Yeah, well, some want to leave because they don't like how Westminster is in control of Scotland, basically. Others want to, obviously, other people want to stay part of the UK because of, because it means being British and things like that. But obviously, it depends on person and what people think. But I think, I think in general, it probably wouldn't really affect England that much because like I said, you can still have your trade deals and things like that. And obviously, it's about money and stuff at the end of the day as well. So.
I actually think that the Commonwealth, a lot of countries are going to leave the Commonwealth eventually. They're talking about it here at the moment, but we're probably 10 years away. When Australia goes, we're going. The day that Australia announces they're leaving the Commonwealth, the next day we're going to be the same. If we announce it, Australia will do it the next day, because we tend to follow each other and start what we do. So, and we're both countries. Countries are talking about at the moment. I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen in the next 10 years or so. It's about 60% for the royal family and 40% against wanting to be independent. But only
the Commonwealth, like if the Queen goes to Canada or whatever, it means something, I think it was. I think we play this stuff that much, to be honest, but yeah.
I had an argument with a Canadian in Mumble one day. He had no idea. He was going on about how the Queen wasn't there, the Queen of, Canada's Queen. Because she's actually the Queen of, but we have, she's our top official, technically. She has nothing really to do with us in normal terms. She can actually sack the Prime Minister, I think, if there's something in the history that says that technically she can actually do that, but I don't think that would ever happen. If that ever happened, we would leave the Commonwealth. I did have a funny argument with a Canadian one day who didn't realise that Canada was part of the Commonwealth.
Yeah, but
it's not anymore.
It still was.
When America used to be part of England, used to be in control of America as well.
When I left in the last 20 years, I was pretty sure that they still are. I just don't think they pay the royal family much attention. They're just there in name only. Our highest court is the English court. And I think it's been changed recently. We've got our own justices of the peace now and stuff, where the highest court in our country isn't the English court. Like we've got the same sort of system that America has with five or six judges that are elected. What's the court over there? I'm not sure what the... the top judges are over there. They have a similar system now. We've got more Americanized lately, like with some, a lot of stuff. Even our political system's changing from the British way of doing things to how the Americans' way of doing things.
Yeah, but, okay, sure, but really, England is kind of Americanized, and on the news, I mean, they're always on the news is a great example. Always saying like Obama's done this, Obama's done that, for example, or whoever the president is at the time. But as far as I know, in America, on the other hand, they hardly ever get to hear about the British government and British and what's happening in Britain, you know.
Yeah,
but that's the difference, isn't it?
We don't really pay the UK much attention. We don't. We used to, they used to be one of our biggest trading partners up until the 1960s. the European countries didn't like New Zealand trading with them, so we used to sell them heaps and heaps of dairy products. And what their own countries were suffering, so they pretty much kicked us out. They really stuffed us up, so we just went to China and Asia, and we're making more money off our dairy products than we ever have, but we've slowly been growing, you know, moving away from, I don't even think a lot of people even see the UK, UK is relevant today, really. A lot of people still love the royal family, but we're not really into it. They have no say about politics at all. That just for the show. I mean, I really, it's just one of those funny things to do with history. Now, the other thing, the problem that we'd have is if we went independent, we'd have to have a president. And probably, you know, they'd probably have a one-off election, so anyone could probably stand. We'd some get some freaking idiot being president of the country. It's be there in name only, but still.
And if Scotland go independent, then really they're meant to have their own currency as well. And then it's like, what are they going to do? Are they going to join the euro, or are they going to, you know?
We don't have that issue. We have our own currency, so that's not a problem. I mean, our country's done quite well at the moment. We've come out of the recession really well. Australia's actually gone downhill a bit because they've. Quite funny because our two countries are very, very different on how we do stuff, like financially. And they've got states that sort of manage a lot of their finances. It gets quite confusing in Australia. Like, if we want broadband, you know, high-speed broadband, the country will just pay a $8 billion contract to someone to go up for high-speed broadband in the country. They just have to take a vote, and that's it. In Australia, every single state's got to agree. You have it in Melbourne, you have it in frickin' Sydney. It's all over the place, their political system. But they've been relying a lot on mining. They were making tons and tons of money off coal, and one thing about the deserts in Australia, they've got heaps and heaps of, they can mine, you know, the mines all over Australia. Now, it was employing a lot of people. Lots of people over here went over to Australia to get jobs at one point, but that's just collapsed. Like, the coal prices, gold prices, and all the mining prices have collapsed. Australia is shit. They've lost, I think they had a $40 billion deficit or something last year. Or something like that, and we're just about in surplus. So, because we're just relying on our dairy, we're just exporting more and more dairy to more countries. We're looking at a trade deal with the US at the moment. So, that's interesting too. The main issue with the trade deal with the US that the US want to bring the pharmacy companies want to bring the prices up here, because they want to control. The pharmacy products that go into our pharmacy, and so we'd be paying sky high prices for medication and stuff like that. It's one thing that's stopping it, I think.
Yeah, globalization.
It's stupid. I don't agree with that at all. I actually don't agree with free trade. I actually think countries should need to be self-efficient, and actually, I think that one of the best countries in the world are ones that export, make their own products, and then export it. They don't rely on another country to bring their products in. And I think if you get free trade, one country normally outweighs the other. We've got a free trade deal with China at the moment. We've just got so many crappy Chinese products coming into the country. It's one way. It's not, there's not many New Zealand companies that are basing themselves in China. They're actually doing well, so it's very one way, and it takes away a lot of jobs as well. Like, companies would move,
somewhere else. Yeah, it happens here as well. People, they get things off China, or people or companies may move off to India to get people there and all that kind of stuff. It happens here as well.
So we're losing a lot of jobs at the moment with factories that are closing down and moving to a Chinese factory that are based in China. And they exported the goods to New Zealand because it's cheaper for them to make them. So, that's one thing that's been annoying lately, just how this right-wing government doesn't really pay much attention to the worker. But, I don't know. It's one of those things. It seems to be on an upward slide at the moment. We've got low interest rates here too at the moment. I think it's like 3.5% or something. Housing... Everyone in New Zealand likes to buy their own house, but the government's just made it a lot harder to buy their own house because they've put the mortgage rate up, the mortgage deposit rate up to about 20%, and it used to be about 5%. So a lot of people are upset about that too, because the only people buying houses are Chinese. These Chinese millionaires coming in and buying up all the properties.
Yeah, most people here that you can't buy your own house. And maybe even a flat would be too expensive. So, even a flat is a lot. So a lot of younger people will just rent or live at home because the high house prices, flats even, it's crazy the amount of money they want. And, even with two people in a couple, you might not be able to just get a house or pay enough off mortgage is massive. That's what I mean.
Yeah, well, it's the same here in Auckland. Like the Auckland house prices are they've gone up 300% or something in the last 3 or 4 years. Something that would be where I am now, like this house would be worth what 190,000 around there. But this house in Auckland would be worth 400,000-500,000. It's just pathetic. A lot of people actually live outside Auckland and drive to Auckland to go to work.
Yeah, but what's kind of interesting is if you go to somewhere else, I got second cousins in Finland. Their parents, I think their house is actually quite a lot cheaper than a house would be here. But they also get, they get a lot nicer place, but then they're sort of near a small village or smallish town, so it's not really a built up area as such. But they live in quite a nice place, and they've got the forest there, and they've got nice wooden house. They've got room to plant their own vegetables. They've got their sauna because it's Finland. The sauna comes from Finland. They've got a little wood bit, and then they've got a lake down the bottom there that they share with the neighbours and an island. And, they get a nice place, but I think for quite a lot less than a house would sell here. What they're actually getting is really what they're getting is a lot nicer in many ways than what you would get here, but for less money. But that's the difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know about, I assume it's like this now as well, but it's the difference between places. And
the Christchurch earthquakes affected people's mindsets over here really badly. The whole idea of buying a house just went out the window. People aren't buying anymore, they don't want to. We've gone off it. It's like every house in Christchurch, and it was a city of 400,000 or 500,000, was damaged pretty much. I think we spent something like 40 billion or something over in Christchurch over to the earthquake. And people just are leaving the city in droves. So it's booming at the moment because they're building all these new houses, but they're just demolishing everything. Like, they've had to demolish every single building and just build it up from scratch.
Here the issue is population to some extent, and a lot of people are coming to UK or England in particular, I assume more so than Wales or Scotland, Northern Ireland. But so there's the whole thing about borders to some extent as well, who's going to be allowed in the country, etc. But that's another issue, that's another topic. But they talk about, I was just thinking with houses, they do try and build new houses here and there, but then the whole price issue, and there's a lot of people who can't really get their own house or their own flat or whatever because of the whole price issue.
You can still find a cheap house to rent here.
You can't really buy unless unless you've got quite a lot of money. And
we wouldn't save that much. There wouldn't be a lot of difference if we bought this house. We haven't got enough money for deposit at the moment, but if we bought this house, we'd still be paying about the same for the mortgage that the rent is. So there's not much point. Really, for us, we're quite happy. We've been here 3 years now. We never see the landlord. The landlord knows we're not trashing the place. So it's like if something happens, like we had a tree fell down, just about hit our lounge in a storm. And you know, the landlord just come around and pay for it to get removed. That would have cost us thousands. So we're quite happy. We've still gone off the whole idea of buying. Like, it's just not a massive thing for us anymore. I mean, lots of people used to make money here off buying and selling houses, and that's where a lot of the money comes from. But yeah, for me personally, it's just not a big thing for me. But my father-in-law, they've just paid off their house in the last, this year. He's been working the same job for 40 years and stuff. But they have a very different view on things, and they have a very different view on that. If you get married, you just buy your own house. My wife's sister has. But so her husband's parents just gave them 50 grand to, for a deposit, because like, they're quite wealthy. So we can't do that. So, you know, it's just one of those things. Unless you've got wealthy parents here, you're pretty much stuck, really.
Yeah. That's what I'm basically saying here as well. The same thing. Unless you've got wealthy parents, or you've somehow got yourself a really good, well-paid job, or with somebody else, you know, relationship, or you pretty much can't really do a mortgage, or it wouldn't really make sense, because you're not, you know, you don't have enough money. You're not earning enough.
My wife would probably get. Her credit would be fine. I haven't earned enough money, so mine would be just zero. But her credit rate, she could probably afford to get a house on her own. Like, she'd pass all the criteria. It's just coming up with we'd need, what, 50 grand, 60 grand for a deposit now. Like, just to buy a cheap, like, rental house. Like, there's not much point. And she moves, like, every 2 or 3 years, too, with a job. She'll move to another store or whatever. So we can't, you know, to me, personally, it's just not worth it.
I'd actually say, things like, university, do you pay tuition fees there?
Well, I did a university degree when I was 33, and I just got a student loan, and that paid for it for 4 years, and I worked part-time during it, and that's just before I met my wife, actually, and I really enjoyed it, because I was in a university town. But the government pays about 30-40% of it. They give a loan for people. The student loan debt's a huge problem here, but I'm saying that I've never, you only pay it back a certain amount each week anyway, so depending on what you're earning, so it's no big deal. It really doesn't even worry me. That's probably one reason I wouldn't be, the banks wouldn't like me if I bought a house, because I have a student loan. But yeah, it's just, you know, it doesn't worry me at all. It's not a big thing. Anyone can get a loan here. I think that's stopped people over 30 getting it recently. So I think I would struggle now. But if you're 18 or 19 or 20, if you're over 21 here, you can just go straight into the university. You don't need to have good qualifications. So a lot of people fail.
That's not the case here, no.
It's different here. But it's quite expensive. You're looking at $5,000, $6,000 a year. For depending on your course, it can be a lot more. Overseas students pay a lot more. They pay $15,000 a year to come to university here, but whatever. It's probably still cheaper in the States, though. The universities make a ton of money off foreign students. They're paying a lot more.
Same here. In fact, really, they sort of up the tuition fees, or said to university you can do £9,000.
Paper here is probably about $1,000 to do. If you're thinking a degree's 21 papers, that's probably, you know, looking at, and then you've got to pay for accommodation.
For some of the top universities anyway, they can do like £9,000 per course or whatever it was. But the difference is, if you go to Scotland, on the other hand, they actually, basically anyone can do a degree. They kind of just let anyone do a degree. That's the difference.
And that's what happens here. But you have 50-year-olds. Yeah, we actually had an 80-year-old that went to university and got himself a teaching degree. You know, 3 years, and just got a teaching, you know, got a degree in teaching, and degrees here are 3 years, but masters are 4. And he just got himself a teaching job. So, I mean, it does work. I mean, I think it's quite useful. Just gives people something to do and look forward to, I guess. But I didn't find it that hard. I was getting C's for most of my papers, but I was passing them okay. But it's quite hard not knowing how it all works when you're going straight in there, and you know, you're not used to that sort of stuff. You can get by if you do go to university here. I think you just got to be a bit it depends on your personality too, I think. A lot of students here just prefer to drink. Just don't worry about it too much, whether they pass or not.
Yeah. And then healthcare is NHS or England and Scotland have something. Well,
you're going on. If I got injured today, like if I broke my leg or whatever, I'd get free healthcare. I'd go straight into the hospital. And if I had a broken neck, they'd send me straight away, and I'd be in the hospital for probably a couple of months and wouldn't have to pay a thing. But if I had something chronic wrong with me, that I needed an operation, I'd go on a waiting list. So you could be looking at a year's wait to get the operation.
There'll be a waiting list for the NHS as well for certain things. But then also, if you've got money, there's the option of private healthcare as well. So people want to pay.
People can get private health insurance has got quite big here actually, because it's not that expensive. It's about $20 a month, $30 a month, whatever it is. So if people want to pay that, they can just go into get healthcare that way. Choose who they want to go to.
Although they're gonna, there was on the news recently actually, they were going to, because apparently some people come to England to kind of take advantage of the NHS and they lose millions of pounds on that. So they were going to charge a lot of the foreign people who come over for healthcare, which is probably fair enough.
See, we don't have the border problem. Yeah, it's the rice quite isolated, so it doesn't worry. The government just writes it off. Like, it's about 20% of the budget, 30% of the budget. But we don't have a defence force or anything. We have a big defence budget. We don't spend anything on defence, really. That's put all in the healthcare and stuff. The hospitals are run really badly because the government runs them. And they tend to be on the bare bones. There's no... I've been in the ER for a gallbladder problem about 6 months ago. And I went in the ER. Every single person in there was American. Like, all the doctors and nurses were just American. It was like being an American TV show. It was quite funny, all these American accents in the New Zealand hospital.
Yeah, the hospitals are quite good here, I think. I mean, I don't normally go to hospital at the moment, but... as far as I know, in general, they're quite good, and the country as a whole is known to be quite good for healthcare, with doctors and so on, but surgeons, etc. But of course, it costs, and so the NHS are always trying to kind of find ways to. There's always talk about how they can save money, because a lot of money goes on that from the taxpayer.
I tend to stay away from doctors and stuff if I can help it. I'm not a big fan of them. They don't really sort problems out. They tend to just see you for 10 minutes, that'd be $50. You still have to pay to see a doctor. And that's quite expensive. You'll get $50 a visit if you want to go to the doctor. You normally will only see you for 10 or 15 minutes, and they can't do much in 10 or 15 minutes. Like, they miss a lot of things. Normally what they do is just give you some medication, like Panadol and freaking ibuprofen or something like that, and that's pretty much what they do. So I sort of get a bit upset with the health system. I think the doctors just don't really have the time to look into a patient. Like, I see all these TV shows in the US, like Grey's Anatomy, and they're spending like about 4 or 5 days like working out what's wrong with the patient. They just don't do that. It's just like and that's probably the one issue with the health system that I'd have.
Doctors, if they've only seen you for 10, 15 minutes, they generally can't do that much. I agree with that, but depends on what you're there for as well.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you've just got the flu. So that's half the time, that's what they say. So it's not like they run tests and stuff and pick sometimes. I find too, the hospitals here, they tend to just run a blood test, and if there's nothing on the blood test and your blood pressure, they send you home. So they miss a lot. Like, people have died from, a proper virus, and it hasn't picked up in the blood tests and stuff here, and stuff like that, because it's a stupid system and the way it's set up. Meningitis kills quite a few people here because the hospitals miss it. It has flu-like symptoms, meningitis, but it kills you in a couple of days, 2 or 3 days. It can be a lot of the Asian students bring it over, but it can be killed quite easily with antibiotics. Yeah, the doctors miss it. They think it's flu, give you something, the wrong medication, send you off your way, and the person's dead in 2 or 3 days. It's probably the worst one, I think. Yeah.
We've got at least one listener, because I've been looking at the IC channel just now. I don't know how many we've got now. Apparently earlier when I was chatting with 330, apparently, according to Ken, this was, we had like 26 listening on the stream, which apparently was more than at the end of the actual New Year's thing, the proper one, you know.
I'll put link to you on Google Plus. It could be some of them. It's one I've got about 300 people that follow me on Google Plus around. I don't know why? I'm pretty hard to keep track of most of the time. I change my page lock and everything every 10 minutes.
I kind of wonder how many are actually listening to us right now, but oh well. And also, I wonder who is actually left, if anyone from the people on this.
Are they idling? Are they? I'll get to know. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if there's quite a few people in here that are idling.
Just keep it up, I guess, for a bit longer.
I think I did that yesterday. I was really tired. I did the first 7 hours. I mean, I'm from midnight my time to about 8 in the morning. And I got really tired about 3 o'clock and just fell asleep. So,
yeah, I don't know. I was there at the very beginning for a little bit. Then I got some sleep, not much. And I was around sort of the evening until about 4 a.m. and then I ended up going to sleep again about 5, I think. And I came back on at what I thought would be the like end of this, but we kind of just like carried on and yeah, it's a lot.
We've been broadcasting Mumble Gear about 20 people into a room, and they'll just ramble on and on like this. You know, it'll be like this all the way through. I actually told them you should record some of this when I was on there, but a couple of months ago when they started off, and some of the people in here actually are from that room, so I had to talk forever.
From where?
Due to the broadcasting Mumble, have quite a big Mumble server. They've just started though.
Yeah, I hadn't done any podcasting since the last one, to be honest, because I've been doing some other stuff like public speaking here and there and things like that. And so when you haven't done it for a year, I was thinking at the end of the summer, I was thinking, oh yeah, the New Year's podcast coming up, that's gonna be fun. And you know, and then you do it and you kind of remember, oh yeah, podcasting is quite fun, because when haven't done it for a year or so, you maybe start to forget how fun it really is.
I actually wouldn't mind doing a podcast or some of the time zone stuffs me up quite a bit, like it's just hard getting people in from the right time zone. Most of the people I talk to on Mumble are in the UK, so it's really hard getting that 12-hour time difference and actually, you know, sorting out time into
me. I think it's 13 at the moment, isn't it? What time is it there now?
If daylight savings comes in from either country, it can be 9, 10, you know, yeah. 11, 12, or 13, depending on what's just what. I like Mumble. I must admit, I prefer to chat than I do type. My typing skills aren't there at all.
I think Sound Chaser might be running out of space for the recording we were saying earlier. But
how are they going to do this? It's going to like have it like play through the whole year. Like they have to save
one. Originally they were going to go 2-hour episodes, and then I don't know about this extra stuff, but we'll see, I guess. And then apparently there's no queue as such to release it, so it might take quite a while to release the whole thing out.
Yeah, I might start. But that's okay. I don't really hang out in IRC anymore, actually. I might have to start hanging out in the Oddcast Planet IRC room. They seem to be, most of the people in here tend to hang out in there anyway, so.
Yeah, it's alright in there. I tend to just sort of stick around in, some of the Media channels, obviously. And some, including my own.
The first Magia user I've ever met. Considering it's like up to about 3 on District Watch.
It was actually number 2 last year, for a lot of last year on DistroWatch, but it kind of went down a little bit, which is kind of a shame. But it's just on page views and stuff. But yeah, it was number 2 for a bit actually.
And then it went back. Theory that Magia have got a page view program. That's clicking on the page all the time.
Well, it's nice little distro, but it's the whole. Have you had a Mandriva before, or Mandrake?
I could never.
Or maybe you've used it even.
It's like Mandriva's a bit like Arch to me. I can never get past. I'm not very good with the text based stores. Be a graphical store. I'm not going to store something. So that's sort of where I come from. From Magia.
Yeah, Mandriva well, they had all these like public company issues the last few years, etc. And so in 2010, a group of former developers basically just lost their job working for Mandriva through Mandriva and company called Edge IT. And so they thought, right, we're going to fork and other contributors as well. And so they decided they were going to fork Mandriva because they were worried about what would happen to it as a distro. And so they decided to start the Madeira project, and it was announced. They had like a meeting in Paris, and then they announced it the next day that they were going to fork Mandriva and stuff like that. And then it takes a while to set up a build infrastructure and all that as well, because before you can make this is a proper fork. This is not based on Mandriva. The first version is quite similar to the old Mandriva 2010 series, but it's really moved since then. It's really moved in the same direction. I mean, it's got the same build structure and all the rest of it. It's not using the repos from some other distribution like Mint is, for example. There was a good talk earlier with Popey about Mint and Ubuntu and how they use the take the Ubuntu repos and things like that. But this is a proper fork in the sense they took the packages and they set up their own build infrastructure and all the rest of it, and set up their own non-profit organization and all the rest of it, and got people interested. And a lot of the former Mandriva community then followed because they were still using Mandriva because they were worried about what would happen to Mandriva. And to be honest, I used other distros. I was a Ubuntu user for years and stuff like that, so I kind of moved on to Mandriva for a bit and then on to this. But it's a good distro, but I think it's lost a bit of the interest in that it kind of seemed to have before in the last year or so, and that's probably why it's gone down a little bit on DistroWatch, to be honest. Yeah, but
DistroWatch is I noticed with DistroWatch too, it all depends if someone has a release. I have a Debian distro that's really like, every 5 minutes. I do quite well on DistroWatch.
Although saying that, if you mean if DistroWatch is done, if there's a release, then sure, because Magia is on a 9-month release cycle, so the last release was in May, and we've actually got a Magia 4 coming out on the 1st of February, so it'll be interesting to see what happens there, but see what happens with the comments online and all the rest of it. But I've got a FOSDEM to go to in Brussels again. There's a big open source event that happens in Belgium, and it's just amazing all these projects getting together.
One thing about me, people say, "Oh, Marcus, you know everyone," but I've sort of gone out of my way to get to know everyone. We don't have those big events here.
You got Linux Conf Fair U, but that's Australia. I think they have New Zealand one year.
I'm not paying $2,000 to go over to Australia for a Linux conference because that's how much it costs. $500 each way. By the time I'd pay for accommodation, it would cost that. And if I was in the UK, I'd be jumping around everywhere to all those conferences.
You can stream online for some of the FOSDEMs. I mean, there's videos up. And there's Old Camp in the UK, which I've been to twice now as well. That's one they like chatting about on HPR at times. And then you get European events like FOSDEM, and there's like two in Germany, and there's a Swedish event, and there's, what else is there? And stuff like that. But I think I think most of the events are probably actually in America for this.
Bob Brown organises quite a bit. He comes in here quite often. He organised a couple of Linux Fests and stuff like that. I think it's not stopped going, John, but I think we're just having a conversation anyway.
carrying on a bit, whatever.
It's all good.
But these events, it's just when I went, anyways, going back to this Magia thing, so they announced the fork and all that, in 2010, I was kind of looking for a project to contribute to anyway and get a bit more involved with, a bit more official, whatever you want to say. And so I thought, like, what can I do? I'm not really doing programming, so what can I do? I'm not really into graphics designer, so what can I do? So I kept a set up an IC channel and Tom from Geo and all that kind of thing. I followed it properly, and then I joined the marketing team, and I did some stuff to do with that since after that and so on. And so when I went to FOSDEM, and you know, some of these people, you know people on IRC or whatever, and you think, oh yeah, that person was, well, you think you know them through IRC and or whatever, and but when you can go to an event and meet some of these people in person, it just really changes it a bit as well, and you kind of realize who is really behind the text or the voice, hey, I suppose, in the case of podcasting.
Quizzup wasn't here one day, and he was talking to someone to get Quizzup to come in here. He'd been arguing, he likes to see it because it's neutral, and him and I will have a chat. He was talking about how he went to this Ubuntu Linux. He's not very, he's quite introvert, Quizzup, and he's not very good with people, like he doesn't like large crowds and stuff. He was quite interested in going to this Ubuntu meeting that we're having. He goes, I've been invited, and I said, I'm expecting like a couple hundred people there. He goes, I'm quite keen, so they want me as a guest speaker or something. And he goes along, and it's like a four people at a pub talking about Ubuntu. So I was really disappointed. I think he was in London. I think he just normally doesn't go.
What's that? The Ubuntu release party or the Lynch's group or
There's one of them around. I can't remember how long ago it was, but it was something to do with something with Ubuntu, I think, in London. There's like four people at the pub, and he's like a bit disappointed. Because I was expecting like a huge wall with heaps of people, and I think it's quite hard to organise those events, isn't it? A lot of the time.
Yeah. Say that again.
It's quite hard sometimes to organise that sort of stuff. See, that's what I'm good at. I'm good at like organising something or marketing something. Or I'm not really at programming and into programming. I'm not that sort of person. So that's probably one difference with me. I'm beginning to do video editing a bit lately, just personally. So I've discovered quite a bit about how to do stuff. So I like to learn stuff like that. And that's where I come from, Linux based software and hardware and that type of stuff. But I like people, I like talking to people, and I think I'd love to be able to go to those sort of events.
You might have a Linux user group over there. But yeah, it'll probably be some in New Zealand as well. Yeah, I mean, with these lugs as well, it can depend. It can just be a pub meeting, and with a few people, it could be maybe some speeches there as well, depending on your lug and what happens. But yeah, mine's a little bit. I joined. It's like I actually went to the event first. This FOSDEM, right? It's 2012. So I hadn't gone to the lug first. Some people go to the lug first, but I went. I sort of did it the other way around. Not that it matters really. But yeah, it can be a bit disappointing, I'd say, as well, if you go to one of these so-called Linux meetings of some sort and there's hardly anybody there. But in this lug, it can be like that as well. It really does depend on the meeting and how many people are turning up and stuff. It could be eight people, it could be 10 at most. It's been around a long time, but I think the people move on and people lose interest and over the years and stuff as well.
I find with Linux, people get really, really involved in Linux for about 2 years, and I've been a bit like that lately, and then they'll just slowly move away into the tech stuff, they just move on to other things.
Yeah, yeah, turns out there's like another group as well that in the city near me where they set up wireless for cheap wireless organizations, whatever they do, and they had like a Christmas thing, and we were invited along our group, and I went along to that, and it's like 30-40 people or whatever all through the evening. I'm thinking, oh, no wonder we don't get that many people going to lug, because it seems quite a lot of them are just going to this other thing, you know, or they're involved with that, so they don't come to lug, even though some of those people were originally from the lug. But that's how it can go as well, I suppose.
Yeah, but the small group's fine, like, as long as you guys, like, I like Mumble, because you get a small group in here with even three or four people and have a really good conversation. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Had three or four people in a group and in the pub talking about Linux. I'd love to do that. That'd be fun for me. I don't talk about Linux to anyone in real life, so I just don't even know what it is. So
yeah, no, I didn't really either as such until this event and lug and stuff, but that's a really nice thing about that kind of thing as well, because you can go off and as people say, you can talk to like-minded people.
And that's one thing that I really enjoy about this project. You can talk to people from all over the world for free and talk about a subject that you're quite passionate about. And I think that's one of the big things for me. It's just because normally it's really hard for me. I do get people involved in open source, and they're really good online, really bad offline. Like, my personality is quite similar offline. I'd like to talk to people and stuff as well. And I just find that lately I've been quite happy just talking on Mumble, because that's where the people are that I want to talk to.
Mumble's good as well. I remember last time Peter said, like, I really like, what did he say? He said, like, it's great having New Year with all you, everyone on here sort of thing, or rather do that than whatever somebody said last time.
I was exactly the same. Like, my wife was working until about 10 o'clock at night, so I couldn't really go anywhere. The only place I could actually go would probably be with your family, and they're all in your 60s and stuff. I really can't be bothered. Like, I've just got to the point now, as I've got older, I'm more than happy. I've done all the student stuff, you know, with the New Year's drinking and stuff. So I'm more than happy now just to sit at home, listen to music, and we'll talk, you know, talk to someone online. I actually quite enjoyed the New Year's event. It was actually quite good.
Oh, yeah, you can have, like, an online New Year's now as well, which is the whole point of this stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a good idea, I think. I think they've been doing it for 5 or 6 years now, I think, too.
Well, what, 5 or 6 years, what?
That's what they do every year, I think, here for public radio.
I don't know, I thought it started about 3 years ago, didn't it? I did it last year and this one.
I think they did mention 5 years, but I think they were talking about how long it's been going for. It could be long, though.
But when I did it first time last year, I thought, great. But there were some food topics, and I was just, food topics been lacking this year. But
that's that why they were talking about, I don't talk about food topics. I don't know what someone mentioned
it. I think it's because it kind of got overdone last time. It came up probably about 6 times or something all the way through.
Cobra, did you get your mic fixed? You're moaning in IRC that your mic was having issues. Probably idling.
I eventually got stuff fixed.
Okay, cool. You sound good too.
Oh, yes.
Sounds like a podcast.
Huh, right. I installed Gen 2 and built Mumble. That didn't work, so then I installed Slackware and built Mumble, and that worked.
It would take a long time just to install Mumble on G2 and install C2. Linux Lite, anyone ever wants a really easy distro for Mumble? Linux Lite's set up for Mumble, it just goes into a different community. It's all the sound settings are all good and everything. It's normally, and it's set up to the right version, so it's a pretty easy distro to download. It's only like 600 megabytes, 700. So
which distro was that?
Linux Lite. So go to the Linux distro community who don't like that. I don't like the creator of Linux Lite too much. But he's actually a user too, actually. It's not that I don't like him, he just doesn't speak to me anymore. So it goes to their community, and that's where Spatry hangs out a lot. I'd rather come in here. If anyone does want that, we'll give help on how to do stuff as well. So, that's just one point.
I'm not really much of a distro hopper. There's really only three that I use: Arch, Gentoo, and Slackware. And that's it.
I've stopped distro hopping, I must admit. I really can't be bothered now. I review distros online. I got so frustrated with it. I got fed up with installing a distro every 5 minutes, you know, every day, that I just decided I'm just going to stick to a couple. And
I did the, in 2009, I went through the whole distrowatch.com list, basically, and in virtual box as well, but I went and tried out pretty much any distro, or nearly all the distros, as long as it said that they were in English, because what I noticed is a lot of them seem to just be like foreign distros, or maybe, but I tried quite a lot of distros out like that, and I went down the whole list in about 2 days or something, and I think other people have done similar stuff, but that's what I did, and I ended up.
Voyager Live's in French, but the distro's in English. You can translate the page to English. Quite a few of them are like that. But, I haven't come across a distro yet that's actually not in English. So I'm just sticking to the Ubuntu-based ones.
Yeah, the things that stand out in a distro to me are the the init system, what init system it uses, whether it's BSD or whatever system crap, and the package manager. I hate apt with a passion. It's probably the worst package manager I've ever used.
Apt, you said, being the worst. that's interesting, because apparently apt is one of the best ones.
That's the only one I know.
No, Quartz is the best, right. Easily.
Have you used Majaro at all, Kuiper, or have you stayed away from it?
No, doesn't sound like one that I've used.
Based on Arch, they use their own, they test their repositories before that, and it's got a graphical installer and everything. It's actually quite nice to look at and stuff. It's got a graphical package manager, but you can use Catman and all that sort of stuff if you want to through the terminal.
Actually, when I run Arch, I use Arch like I use Gentoo. I build everything from source using the ABS stuff.
Is he one of those people? I might talk to him.
Well, I don't need a generic Linux install. When I install Linux on something, it's only going to be on that specific hardware. I don't need portable packages because I usually have different architectures. For example, I've got an Atom, I've got an i5, and I've got a Celeron, and a couple of ARM units and MIPS. So what's going to be beneficial to me to have a local repository of packages?
I think anyone that uses Linux, though, it's all what they discover, I think, after a couple of months, what they actually like, whether it's KDE or whether it's XFCE or whatever. And they just find a distro that's got that they like, that's got that community, if they like Ubuntu. But, and if they do get into that whole thing of doing it their own way, they could, that's all good. There's nothing wrong with that. I think that's mainly what Linux is actually really useful for. I think, if anything, there's a bit of conflict in the Linux world about people get quite uptight. I've got my system, you should be doing the same thing. And I think everyone's different. I think it's just a matter of just agreeing to disagree with, not talking about you, Cobra, but people in their own conflict, with what distro someone's using. It should be completely up to the user what they use.
Yeah. Me and 330 earlier had a bit of a discussion about that. How it should be, like, this, my distro is better than your thing is, well,
yeah, I know.
It kind of holds back the whole of Linux back from getting more popular, because people will get confused, or they'll think it's just a load of fighting between distros, or and that kind of stuff as well.
That's what I've been, I've got really fed up with it, so I've got really fed up with the conflict in Linux. Like, you can't do boot, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. Like, I can do whatever I like, it's nothing to do with you. I'm not having to go on what you're using, if I want to learn about Magia, and that conversation got me interested, I'd go and have a look, find out some information, and I'll learn about it. If I want to learn about what Cobra has just done, I'd do that. That's what I like to do. I just think that people should, try and teach someone how to use someone rather than tell them they're, on a crappy distro, because half the time they've never used that distro to actually know what they're talking about anyway. But I've never used Magia. I'm not going to say Magia's crap, so I've never used it. So, and I think that some people just get caught up in the whole mine's better than your thing.
I don't understand the wanting to install distros inside a virtual machine. If it's not on the actual hardware, how do you know what it can do?
Yeah, I must admit, people, I do understand people's point of view on that. If you're on YouTube reviewing distros, it's really hard to do an install every day and actually have a play around with something. Like, you do get some idea of how a distro is going to work in virtual box, even if it's not 100%, and that's where they are coming from. But in saying, some people do try and review stuff for a different distro full of store every day. But then they just install it and just do a 5-second look, and it's like pointless anyway.
Well, for example, if you do a Gentoo install in a virtual machine, it's going to take you 4, 5, 6 times as long, unless you have a really good motherboard that lets you use all the cores on your processor.
Well, Well, yeah, I mean, if you do a disk from a virtual machine, depending on your hardware, it can be a bit slower than the real install. On the other hand, it could be the other way around, possibly. But I think with the virtual machine, it gives you a taste of the distro, and it gives you an idea what it's like. And you said, what's the point doing it in the virtual machine? Well, I think you do need to I'm thinking quality assurance here, because with IDEA, what happens is, obviously, the distro, these development versions and the final, what will become the final and all the rest of it, gets tested out on real hardware, obviously, by certain people, that's important. But it also gets tested out in VirtualBox. And what happens sometimes, actually, is people come along to a QA team and they think, right, you know, I want to get involved with this. I want to do QA, I want to do some ISO testing, but I don't know if I want to install it on my computer, or they're not really sure. And so sometimes they say, like, what if I download the ISOs and test out in VirtualBox? Will that be okay? Can I do quality assurance testing like that? And in general, the answer to that is yes, you can. But my point I'm trying to make is, really, in the case of something like that, you need to kind of test your distro out on real hardware, importantly, but also in the virtual machine as well. Because, and in fact, some people, they will only really try out the distro in a virtual machine. So if it doesn't really work there, it doesn't. They might get a bad impression. But that also brings up something else, actually. I'm not sure what happened quite, but that was an idea to have an official image made for virtual machines of Magia 3, and something got made, but I don't know, but that's like an appliance, an official image, and that's good as well to have something like that for distros, an official image for virtual machines.
See, I could probably try Magia in a virtual box, because I know it's quite hard to install, so I'd like to know that I can install it.
What's hard to install? Which one?
Magia. I'm no good with like text commands and stuff.
No, it's not like that at all. It's got a graphical installer.
Yeah, I think haven't tried Magia.
No, always had. I think it always had.
The thing with me with Magia, it's quite large. I'd stay away from anything over 2 gigabytes normally. I like the light distros anyway. I think you guys have got like the desktop, like all the desktops on
Magia. No, there's different install media actually. There's a big one called the classical installer, which is about a gigabyte or something, but that's because it gives you sort of everything, or it's all there. So when you go through the install, you can say like, I want to have workstation, I want to have a server, I want to have this and that desktop. You can then select what you want. So that's the big one, yes. But then all the live medias are quite small. There's live media. In fact, there's even a. In fact, to make things even smaller and so on, ISO wise, what they did is they. In certain ISOs, they dropped everything except English to make it smaller. And so there's various install ISOs. And if you want really small, you could even do the you could even go for the dual CD, which isn't really recommended for new users as such, but it would let you install it, and it would detect if your computer's 32-bit or 64-bit and give you the right one, and then you can install whatever else from the repo. So if you want to go absolutely tiny, there's even that option. But I would recommend one of the live medias, because then you can get whatever else from the repos anyway once it's installed, basically.
There's nothing. I mean, it's something I'd like to. PC Linux was off Mandrake, wasn't it?
No. Also, these distros have this graphical control center, which is quite nice, and things like that. So it's got the user-friendly touch. But PC Linux OS, I use that. I give it a good. Going back to what somebody said. About virtual machines, like, how can you know if you're really running what this distro is about if you're only doing it in a virtual machine? So what I did before, actually, whilst I was waiting for Magia 1 final to be released back in 2011 or 2010, well, 2010, September 2010, you could say, to when it got released, because I'd given PC Linux Service a try here and there in VirtualBox, and I always looked at it and thought, like, oh, I don't know about how it looks, and I don't know if I want the ball and desktop and things. I wasn't really being fair to pieces in XOS, you know? Yeah, and there was a guy who was saying to me, look, you should these links is always just great, because he was using Mandriva before and all that. So I thought, you know what, I'm gonna give piece of service a fair try, and I put it on my computer for real in sort of, I think it was November 2010 to say March 2011 or something like that. I gave it a 5 months. That was my distro. That's what I used on my computer for 5 months. I gave it a fair try. And, well, yeah, PC Linux OS is quite a good distro as well. And it was forked from, I think you were asking me if it's, yeah, it was forked from Mandriva back in, Mandrake back in 2003 by a former developer. So, and then they've a little bit like Magia, because then it's gone all in its own direction since then, the infrastructure and packaging and all the rest of it. So yeah, so in that sense they are in the same distribution family really, because, and so you'll find the control center that I was on about in PC Linux OS as well. And but when I tried it out, yeah, it was worked well enough. But I think the only thing with PC Linux OS, as great as it sounds to have a stable rolling release, as in a bit like Arch, except it's a stable rolling release, when the updates are stable enough, then they give you those updates. As great as that sounds, I think fine if you're using KDE or something like that. But I think the thing with PC Linux, I'm not sure exactly, but I think they pretty much dropped GNOME 3. They're not really bothering with it anymore. There is like a GNOME spin, but I think officially they don't really support GNOME 3 anymore. I'm not sure exactly, but it's just kind of the impression I get from the website and IRC, and that's the kind of sad thing as somebody who likes GNOME 3, because, you know, I'd want to run that in there. But yeah, that's a distribution that's worth a look actually as well, if you want to try something different. And surprisingly, actually, with PC Linux OS, there's a program called a TV program called BBC Click here in the UK, and it's mainly aimed at people who have a vague interest in technology and not particularly interested, and so they'll go on about Twitter and Facebook and things like that as well, and what sites you can go on and some of the stuff going on with tech. But I remember that one time they actually had an episode where they, in part of this webscape at the end where they're showing you sites and mobile apps and all that kind of stuff, they actually mentioned PC Linux OS, and I thought that was really surprising, because normally a show like that would only, if they're going to mention Linux at all, they would go on about Ubuntu, and it was just really surprising that they mentioned PC Linux OS, but that happened in this one episode.
Yeah, PC Linux, I think, the first distro I tried in 2010, about the same time you did it. I think it's what, but then I went to Ubuntu after that and mucked around with Ubuntu based stuff. But I found it, I've tried it since, I just found that software in it quite outdated. Like, they might have done some updates. I haven't tried their last update. But yeah, and that's probably why I've stayed away. I do think it's quite nice and stable though. But yeah, for me personally, it's not something I'd use. There are quite a few people recently that have switched though, but it's not my thing. I'm going to be muted for a little bit, guys.
Yeah. I think we've got listeners still, but who is here other than...
I'm still here.
Do you want some help with your mic, Purple?
Nah, I'm okay. I was just eating. So I just king up the mic so you know I was still around.
True enough. So I've just been muted, but I've been listening, guys. I can't talk with my wife in the lounge. She's going off to work today in a couple of hours.
I've just kind of been in and out. It's snowing here, and I have been shoveling, and but I've been listening off and on.
Nice summer's day, yes.
It's dark here, and has been for about 4 hours or so. Yeah. Only a bit after 8 p.m., but of course it's winter, so yeah.
Yeah, you must be an hour behind us, but 12 hours ahead, so you'd be what, 8 in the morning?
No, I said 8 p.m. in the evening, just about after.
9:20 in the morning.
Yeah, 13 hours time difference.
I'd just go AFK for a bit, guys.
You're going away for a bit, yeah, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.